Right, this is going to be the third episode of Counterpoints with me and Maniac. We will have some guests in the future. We're still easing into it. And also, what people don't appreciate is, because me and you actually have never done a show before, Maniac, beyond like the odd episode, we actually haven't had that many on-camera discussions about even like famous things in CS. There's plenty of topics to cover and things I'm sure people don't necessarily... I mean, I don't know all of your opinions on certain topics, but I thought one thing we could actually talk about is, and I'm not trying to do the sort of talking counter thing of just being like, hey, I see this on Reddit today, guys, so let's get some and get... No, actually, for real, everyone at the moment obviously wants to talk about CS2, right? I don't really. Like, if you notice, Maniac, as with many things in esports, I am taking my classic role of sort of curmudgeonly old Counter-Strike boomer and being like, shut up talking about that bloody beta, William. We're still playing CSGO. Because I'm still sort of on that, like, until the tournament's end, Maniac. I can't really look to CS2. I have to care about the matches going on now. Like, I have to care if someone wins Pro League and gets a notch on the Intel Grand Slam. That's like the world I'm in. And also, to me, this is one thing we'll get into. If you just know betas and when games aren't developed yet, a million things could change between now and then. Like, the things that seem so important now could be fixed tomorrow. Or, here's something no one even talks about, we'll get into. Some of them might never be fixed. That might just be the game. And by the way, this is why one thing I think we'll discuss on this episode. You might just actually have to accept that there are things about the future sequel/update that you don't like that are just the game. Because, spoiler, we've all done that with past versions of Counter-Strike. So I thought one thing we could get into, at the risk of sounding condescending. So I say that as always a disclaimer. My whole content's condescending. I'm essentially an elitist. If you don't like my stuff and how deep I go, get the fuck out. And if you don't, because no one does, that's also because I've sort of learned how to make it almost like charming to be like, get the fuck up, but don't really, just stay and be like, oh, bloody Tharin and his ego, just get to the episode. So here's what we're going to talk about. I thought we could talk about actually some of the meta discussion around CS2 and the idea of a sequel and a beta and what does it mean, and we're switching over. So one thing I want to ask you about initially, Maniac, is we've often discussed this the few times I have done shows with you, because I actually do. What's funny is people think I'm BMing you, but like, it's going to sound BM. Obviously, I know law about CS 1.6 specifically out of all the esports games. It might be the one game where I know almost everything. Like, I was basically there from day one. I even knew the American scene. I was friends with them. I used to step to like 4 in the morning talking to K-Sharp and all those people. But as a result, right, it sounds BM when I always say that, like, you're a source player, because I do just delete that period where you played 1.6. But to be fair, if people don't know, it's because Maniac wasn't at the top of the thing. He wasn't at, like, World Cyber Games with me. It was more like he was in some of the teams that went to ESWC, the French tournament, and he was like... So it's not quite as bad as it sounds when I say that. But the reason I bring this up is because one thing I took for granted is because you played 1.6 and Source, I actually wonder, what is your take when CSGO came along? What was your vibe? Were you actually one of the people who was... Because here's the thing I've noticed. In general, the Source people only complained about some of like the bad early beta versions. The fundamental things that people from 1.6 might not like essentially are similar to Source. I noticed the Source people didn't have this big a deal. What was your vibe when CSGO came along, when the beta of CSGO came along? Did you actually want to switch? Did you think it was good? Was it the future for you?
So just for history context very quickly, this is not BM at all. The reason you had no idea about me 1.6 is that I was always... I was at the top of Switzerland 1.6, and that's it. Yeah, I never made it past. Okay. So that's it. Basically, we were the people who would show up at ESWC and WCG and lose our three group games, and then we'd visit the city and have a good time. This is where I stopped. The highest I went was playing like EPS. Remember the German league? Midfield EPS. That's it in 1.6.
Okay.
Then I had a few months in CS Source, about 9 months, one of which I spent undercover playing with Very Games at the time, so that was kind of fun.
Oh, like you were like a secret trialer or something. What was going on with that?
Yeah, I was. So actually, Source was really my gateway to any of the elite French scene.
Okay.
Because at the end of Source, NBK had a moment where he wasn't sure whether he wanted to keep playing the game, and I was at the top of the list to replace him in Very Games. Like, people don't know. It's not public information. And now, I mean, there's obviously prescription. Who cares?
That's wild. So people don't know NBK was pretty young at the time, wasn't he? Like,
yeah,
16
at the time, like, yeah, exactly. And he had a couple doubts about what was going to happen in the future. So I got to play practice with him for, I think, about 2 to 3 weeks. That's why I got to know everybody.
That's pretty hype.
Apex, Existence, and all of that. And then, obviously, he decided to stick with the game, which, obviously, they kept him. That made sense. But that was kind of my gateway to knowing all of these people. Now, the hype that I had about CSGO was before it felt to me like both worlds were kind of going to collide. And I liked that idea because I had played 1.6 my whole career. And then I played a little bit in CS Source, and I could see towards the end of 2012 or 2011, at probably 2012. I could see that the source scene in France was actually kind of overpowering the 1.6 scene, which was dying slowly. I think it was the same in the European slash world scene. It was a little bit dying off slowly. And there was a whole lot of hype going on in source. And then suddenly both these worlds collide. And I'm a fan of a few players in 1.6. I'm a fan definitely of a couple players in source. And I'm thinking, hell, this is like, we're putting everything on a tabula rasa. We're starting at zero. Right? Everybody jump in.
Yes.
So I was super hyped by the idea. Mega, mega hyped. Now, I'm going to be blunt. First version of CSGO is dog shit. I hated it. I absolutely, profoundly hated it. In Source, when I joined, and I'm sure this is going to spark some good old debate. When I joined Source, I thought the game was very easy. I came from 1.6. Yes. I had a beautiful time. Case in point, 9 months later, I was being tested by almost the best team.
If people don't know, for some weird reason, one thing that I've noticed is a trend, even though a lot of the Source players, I can tell they didn't play well enough 1.6. I know what you mean, because essentially everything just feels like it hits way easier. Like the AWP feels like it's easy to use. It's famously, the spray feels lovely. If you come from 1.6, where it's like that AK spray is really hard.
It
feels amazing, doesn't it? I've actually heard a lot of people say the same thing. It's why actually I always thought it's weird that 1.6 people really hard hated on Source. But actually, when I played Source, I didn't like it just because it wasn't 1.6. But I actually always thought it actually seemed like it was a pretty good game.
I think there's some sort of like superiority complex where it's like 1.6 would look at Source and be like, ah, that's an easy game. You don't have the same team skill ceiling as we do. So I felt that. I joined Source. I had a really good time. I was immediately one of the best in the French scene out there. And then Go came out, and it took me at the very least 3 to 4 months to start like feeling the game. I thought the movement was very clunky. It felt like my character was continually running with jam on my feet. I could never be clear in my counter strafe and strafe. The spray was all over the place. The sound was horrifying. But I felt like they were relatively quick to update, and the game became playable and enjoyable probably, let's say, 4 to 6 months after the release. So I think now what we're going through with CS2 coming out as well is that we're not in the same situation, right? Esports was obviously relatively developed at the time when Go came around. There were obviously some competitions here and there. There were a few professionals. There was a community already. But now, obviously, it's been exponentially developed. The scene that we have and the odds that are riding on all these competitions and all. So I don't think we can do a one-to-one by comparison. We cannot just say, hey, well, let's just run in with CS2 now, even though it's obviously flawed with a couple of issues and that's a problem. That there's so much more on the line. So I think comparatively, CS2 is now in a very acceptable position as a beta to feel. There are obvious flaws and obvious issues that need to be addressed. But if you were to compare how CSGO was forced down our throat, oh my God. People have no idea. People have no idea how clunky the game was when it came out. And I would argue CS2 is already in a better place than CSGO was. I still don't think it's competitive ready. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about it down in this podcast. I don't think it's esports ready quite yet, but it's in a very good position for how early we are.
Yeah, one thing I think might be a bit lost is, as far as I know, I think everyone thought CSGO was bad when it came out. Like, you have to remember, guys, there was no native CSGO player because the game's only just come out. You were either a Source or a 1.6 player, or maybe you were like one of those weird people who played, I don't know, Quake, and you just played the new game. Almost everyone really flamed that initial beta, especially like the first few months that you're talking about. Because as you say, it was way worse even than CS2 is now. Like, everything was bad. Like, as you say, the movement was fucked. There was even this weird thing people remember where it felt like you were skiing, you know, when you did the AD like that, and it could make you like run. It was just weird. Like, essentially, none of the mechanics were like Counter-Strike. Famously, at the time when the game first came out, it actually was one of those ridiculous things as well, where like you would use things like, I can't remember exactly the ones, but I think he used like SMGs were more powerful or something. You know what I mean? Like, it was all weird shit like that. And then especially stuff like, as you say, the sound design was terrible. In fact, one thing I always do give up is one area. Often I do it, so make note when I do. But I will totally give it up to Valve. I was 100% wrong on the sound change they made like in like 2015 or whatever it was. And they were 100% right, because I was one of the people at the time who bitched, like, oh, why have you changed it? Because remember, initially, when they made that sound mix change, this is years into the game, actually, it sounded like things like the USP silenced famously sounded all weird, didn't they? Like it doesn't sound like it's got any like power to it. But the joke now it sounds amazing. Now it sounds exactly what you should with like a little James Bond sniper sound. Meanwhile, back then, essentially we had no palette audially. Like everything was just incredibly loud. Like the Deagle and the AK spray and the AWP fire were a joke. Like when I even hear those back in an old VOD now, you get like, it's jarring. You're like, holy, We just listen to that all the time in our ears, like when we were playing, like forget like your kinder this close to a monitor. What was that doing to our ears when we had the sound all pumped up to hear the footsteps? Like the AWP was ridiculous. It was like Thor's fucking hammer raining across the sky. Like, man, I can't even believe we were watching old Kenny S games with that, like blowing our eardrums out. So back then it really was bad. Like that, I mean, I'm even talking about some stuff that took some years to develop, but the initial beta was really atrocious. But the problem here as well is I have a sort of nuanced point. It's actually made more sense that it sucked back then, because another reason a lot of people were bailing on CSGO early, and a lot of actually the all-time great 1.6 players, it's not even that they couldn't transfer over like people like Trace. A lot of them just flat out retired and did not even attempt to play, or you know, they played in like a mixed team for 2 months and they were like, yeah, stuff this, I can't bother. It's because the actual messaging from Valve was very different. Like, you'll probably remember this. People in Source were hyped because it was a similar looking game as Source, and obviously famously they invited the Source players a bit like they did now with CSGO people to test the game. But they didn't, if people don't know, invite anyone from 1.6, because at the time Valve had a very weird relationship with 1.6, where essentially it really was like the red-headed stepchild that lives in the attic. Because if you remember, that game had been out years at that point in time. It was talking, it'd be like 12 years or something. Meanwhile, Source, which was the game they made with their company years into this process, like halfway in, famously wasn't really like fully adopted, and stuff happened. Like, even though tournaments, if you remember, took it over in 2005 and 2007 with CGS and World Cyber Game, eventually it got rejected. Like, it had this brief period when it had some focus, but essentially left to its own devices, the esports industry decided we're sticking 1.6 actually. And Valve, one, it wasn't really the game they made. Like, that was the game Gooseman made and they just owned. But more importantly, like, back then, there wasn't like the subscription, like, way of making games and freemium models and stuff like that. There's things like World of Warcraft, but that was actually quite rare back then. Remember, this is like when like League of Legends stuff sort of just come out. Like, you didn't really have this approach now of, like, the way you make a game is more like Netflix, you know, like people pay you on like a semi-regular basis and they buy items. That wasn't the vision back then. Back then it was, you just sell a game for as much as you can at retail point, and that's where you make all your money. So back then, I have to say, if you looked at how they invited the people out, they did this really weird thing when they were launching Go as a beta, which is they kept saying it wasn't a sequel. They kept saying that's why it wasn't called CS2 back then. They kept saying, right, that it was some sort of like a spin-off within the franchise and that all the games could coexist, because they were trying to sort of gaslight you that, like, if you're like 1.6, that'll still exist. It, I mean, technically it did. It's just like some kid in an Indian server or something, you know, but so they're not wrong, but you know what I mean? Like, they tried to make it sound like, you know, it's not a negative, you know, it's just more things you like. And if you remember, they even tried to flex at the time that it was going to be this like console port and it would be on the Xbox or something, which I believe it was, but I think again, it was one of those ones where like either it connected you to PC players, you get murked, you have no chance. Or I think barely anyone played it because it was like a console game. If you think about, we've all got PCs in the 2000s, really makes sense. So when all that stuff happened, basically what the esports industry took from that is like, oh, this is like a cash-in. They're just doing it because it's the Counter-Strike name. What they've sort of done is they've realized after a few years, everyone knows the name Counter-Strike. Like Call of Duty, you should make a new game, and then everyone buys the new game and goes, oh, CS, I remember that game, and you make a load of money. And so if people don't know, I always tell them this. CSGO wasn't made by Valve. It was made by those people who fixed Source famously, the Hidden Path Entertainment people. They actually initially farmed the game out. They made the shit version, and then Valve just sort of tweaked it, and then it became CSGO. So as I always say this, the interesting detail a lot of people don't know about CS history is of the three games, 1.6, Source and Go, it's only Source that actually Valve made. That was their game. The others, one was made by just some guy from Southeast Asia, like whatever, 20 years ago, just a modder. And then CSGO was made by this company which had come in to fix Valve's mess in Source. So to me, I remember even seeing that. And I don't, here's the thing, I'll definitely roast them now, but I don't blame, if you remember, people like ESL who were openly messaging, like, this is not going to be an Intel Extreme Masters. Like, we don't think this game is actually like a tier one esport, basically. By the way, they weren't wrong at the time, but the problem is that's mad depressing if you come from CS, because if you know CS, we were always in the status we are now. We're always at least top three, you know, we're always one of the premier games. Like at the end of the joke is we were being consigned to sort of the status of games like Quake, where, you know, one TO might want to run some tournaments, but the rest are sort of like, that's not the biggest esport, is it? That's just a sort of like a side thing. Because if you think about it, back then, games like League of Legends were eating our lunch, mate. They were getting way more viewership, it was free to play. The joke is back then, everyone in the world played League of Legends. I'm not joking, guys. The daughter came out for free. Like, mate, it was looking really bad. And so that's why I always tell people the interesting piece of trivia in history, because it's just the ultimate, like, Trivial Pursuit game. If I made Trivial Pursuit Esports, this would be the one that makes sure you never get the wedge, because I'd fuck you all with this question. It would be, what was the name of the major that Virtus Pro won? Because every fucker will go, ESL won. No, I've done you there. because the reason it was EMS, and Maniac should know this as a Source player, Major Series, guys, was the level below Intel Extreme Masters. Intel Extreme Masters was like the premier brand, what it is now. The joke now is they've actually combined the brands again, and it is now the premier brand. Major Series, what they used to put Source in, that's what they used to be sort of saying, like, if you're in a game like World of Tanks or Source, you're in sort of like the little kids table, and this is where you compete, which if you notice, didn't have giant lands. It was more like you played online cops and ladders, like you say, EPS. Maybe you get like one LAN every six. So actually, we were put on this track where if you were basically a top pro in 1.6 specifically, because in Source, since the scene hadn't been as big, to some degree, some of these guys could handle the fact that like we're starting small again. If you were a 1.6 player, like think of some of the people you see on Twitter now, like my mate Valet, who just came back and doing all these tweets. If you're some of those guys, your vibe goes like this. Wait, so I've just been competing like for the last 5 years, hardcore, and maybe I'm making what to me is good money. Like, let's say I make €1,000 a month. I think SK used to make like 1,400 a month or something at the end of the game, right? And if I win, let's say like most of the, let's say I have one of those years where my team's the best team of the year. No joke, I can do all that work, and if I'm in the best team of the year, I make like total salary and winnings, maybe I make like €25,000 that year. The vision for CSGO was, now just, basically, you might get like a fourth of that if you're lucky. So essentially, you're now a hobbyist. You're not even doing it like full time. And by the way, this is why I'll never blame the Nordic people. If you're someone like Valet, mate, you live in fucking Sweden, mate. You can't live off that. The joke is you probably barely live off like being the best team. Like I just said, you're still going to be sort of like a mild social outcast for doing it. You aren't just going to be sat indoors all day. So like, I don't think people really understand like this.
No.
Have you noticed? I haven't talked about the game that much. It's the ambience of the scene was totally different. Like, this was a totally different world. Yeah. Like, this is why a lot of people, you know, everyone makes fun of that comment where Zonic said like, he'll never be as big as one. But at the time, he was right. Wouldn't have. That's why I always do give credit for the things like this, the skins aspect and the fucking pit operations and the major kit. Like, I never saw that as an angle coming, mate. That came out of left field for me. I remember when they even announced it. I'm even one of the famous boomers who said, who the hell's going to buy a skin? Like, well, those classic fucking, you know, like, who's going to buy this Bitcoin? I was almost on that level. Because I remember thinking like, yeah, like a skin's cool, but who's going to like pay money for it? And obviously the joke now is, people are obsessed with that to this day in 2023. Like, they're all going mad over it. Yeah,
for the anecdote, you're talking about Katowice. The first major I played in Katowice with the stage, we had the corner of the stage. We had a quarter of the audience watching us, and League of Legends had the main side.
There you go.
At the time, you'd have two distinct scenes. One would be on the quarter of the Spodek, and the other one would be the half of it, which is the whole grand scene. And we had the small part of it. That was a small part when we lost to VP.
Yes.
That was the moment. So, yeah, definitely, I think the environment, both financially and socially speaking, is much different now than we were when we went from CS 1.6, CS Source to then CSGO, compared to now CSGO to a potentially new jump. I think in all credit due, CSGO did sort of organically grow with a couple of ideas that came in. You talk about the skins, and then we slowly but surely systematically grew, and then it exploded. And then we became who we are now, very unified as well. I also think, obviously some financial reasons behind it, but both 1.6 and Source to an extent suffered massively, like 2008, 2009, like financially sponsors were backing out. I remember in Switzerland, there used to be a very vivid and alive scene in Switzerland for regional events where you'd get, I don't know, let's say 2,000 to 3,000 euro for the winning team, which is relatively decent. All of these events were just wiped out in 2009, 2010, just basically disappeared. I stopped playing 2010 to probably 2011. I was studying my bachelor degree because nothing was happening. There was nothing happening. There was no regional, there was no influx of cash anymore. So CSGO kind of rekindled that flame, and then we created what we have now, which again is why we are in such a different situation that we cannot just compare the one-to-one jump. This is a whole different situation. I also don't think CS2 has any intention to regroup any kind. We don't need to regroup anybody. We already have a community that we just want to expand. I think the idea is just trying to grab more people from the outside, because as much as we are elitist and we're focusing on esports and we talk about the very highest level, we also do depend on a very green grassroots kind of ability to grab people from the outside and get new eyes in the game, get new intents. That is what I think CS2 is trying to do. And in that sense, I think some people are probably a little bit too self-absorbed in how they react to it. And they say, oh, what is this shit? Why now do I have two different cap of color to my smokes? My game should be a higher skill ceiling. And the competitor in me says, okay, I hear you. You want a game that's harder to play because you want a higher skill ceiling. I understand that. I respect that. But we do have to, or we do, we don't have to, but it'd be great if we find a way to grab new people to make our game grow even more. We have such good momentum with CSGO. Now, we're definitely up there, the best games ever in terms of esports. There's no debate. We have such a nice kind of launch pad, which is why I think we should really wait for CSGO to be in a good position. I wouldn't want people to be jaded by a forcing onto CSGO the way we were about CSGO.
Yes. Because
the whole landscape is different.
Yeah, there's actually a few things on that I'll pick up. Like, one is, this is like a subtle point that a lot of people will miss, is that the one area you're absolutely correct in is, even though I actually don't think this is like going from 1.6 to CSGO, or when like a brand new actual, like when Quake 4 comes out after Quake 3, right? That is a moment where in theory, because it is a totally new game, you actually can have some like radical change in the demographic. Like, for example, maybe loads of people do join the game. I mean, put it this way, I get the vibe this will happen in CS2, but from having seen a lot of the games on the last 10 years, I think it'll be more like, you know, when a game comes out, an example I would give is like Apex Legends. For the first week, every streamer was playing it, weren't they? Suddenly they didn't play Fortnite or whatever was the big game at the time. They just played this Apex Legend. Now, I've heard also they were also like paid like influencer style to stream it, etc. But basically, it was just for like the novelty that they played it. And then after like a week or whatever, they went back to Fortnite or PUBG or whatever they came from. And essentially, if you were just the variety streamer, that was just the week or two you played Apex Legends. I think there'll be a bit of that. There'll be some people who are like, hey, I used to, you know, play CS back in the day. Let's boot this up, guys. Hey, let's have a look. Be a bit of that. I don't think it'll actually have like, I don't think it will like triple the population base of the game or whatever. I imagine it'll be mainly CSGO people. But the reason why it is actually relevant to think about though, Maniac, is this is an area I think people are really missing. The online era, to me, the worst thing it did was kill off loads of the legendary players. Like people like Kenny S. It's just because, like, if he had any motivation issues before, it was gone when it's just online games. He just stopped playing the game. Same with Guardian, etc. And so the real problem is, like, no one's giving these people a chance. In fact, let's be real. The ship has sailed for most of them. Forest, Guardian, Kenny S, like, Scream, probably, if you wanted to come back. Like, people at this point in time, the real problem is, in Europe, we still have those FPL, like, pipelines. We have the academy teams. We're still churning out legit talent in Europe. And obviously people know the real irony is if it wasn't for that bloody Ukraine-Russia conflict, we'd have an insane amount of European talent. If all those Russian players could just join any team, it would be absurd right now. Like the joke is Na'Vi would actually be a mental, like they could have the best players in the world. So there is a type pipeline of talent, but the obvious one where it has died is North America. And I can tell you right now, it's not just things like Flashpoint and the ESL Cup. No, all the talent in NA who weren't people like Elise, who were already established, just went to Valorant. You can just go and look. When you go and look in Valorant and you see those names that were in, like, the Optic team was number one in RG, and then you have these... They're all just Valorant players, mate. The Cloud9 team was, like, no joke, at CSGO players, rather. When you go and look, nearly all the, like, top talent were former CSGO players. They were the people who were in teams in Flashpoint. Like, you know, they're not quite made it. Like, we're like the sixth best NA team, or we're like the 48th best team in the world. They all just switched to Valorant, basically. And so the real problem you have is this. I do get the sense that the reason why regions like NA are dead isn't just that there's no tournaments. It's that everyone who's a new player there in Attack FPS just starts in Valorant. Like, everyone's playing it. It's the hype. It's got all the tournaments. It's even got some success relative to what CSGO has in NA there. And so I think that's just the game that a noob plays now, essentially. They don't come and play CSGO as the first game. So if we can win any of those people, but I think that's actually key. I think if you don't do that, the real problem is, like, we can just have it be a European game. I've seen games, you know, shrink in size and sometimes only Korea players like StarCraft or whatever. It's fine. You can still have really good games, but you're not going to have the scene that we had in CSGO. Like, remember in CSGO, we're like, NA, yeah, it would fluctuate, but we don't have times where it was very healthy. And in fact, you even know this will be radical to modern day fans. There was an era back when you were still a player actually in CSGO where even though people didn't want to go to NA, it was famous if you were actually like tier 3 EU, you could go there and get like 5k a month just playing for some like 8th best team that no one even thinks is good, and you could actually like live in a team house. Like, there was actually like legit now obviously there's none of that. There's like sort of like Complexity, half of Team Liquid, and then what, EG, that's about it. So right now the actual the issue of could we get people instead of them playing Valorant is big, and a new game can do that. The one concern I have, though, is I actually do think that this is why I've never been one of those people who thought Valorant would kill CSGO, or that CSGO meant that like Valorant wouldn't work. I get the vibe. I don't know about you, because I know you know some people like Existence who do the Valorant scene. It actually seems to me, mate, like beyond the people who switched, and it's either like super old boomers who weren't good anymore in CSGO, or it's the young crop who haven't made it yet. Aside from those people, I actually do get the vibe Valorant is like a distinct enough game that it has its own player base, its own fans. I don't get the sense that they're really competing in that sense, you know, Maniac. Like to me, a lot of the people who play Valorant, like I'll give you a reason that people are going to laugh at, like, some woke shit. It sort of is. Like, every time I ever go on the Valorant subreddit or I hear people complain about the game, there's a lot of bitching about things like this person, look, a clip of like, look, they were rude to me in like so lucky or whatever. It's like, bro, we wouldn't even waste our time with that in CSGO. Like in CSGO, no one thinks you're going to get banned for flaming someone over the mic. Like that's not even entering your brain. Like CSGO is just like, I mean, you can call it toxic masculinity, whatever, but it just is that sort of a game, isn't it? Like it's like the old school famous example of like if people went on COD back in the day. Yeah, of course, everyone says they fucked your mother while doing a 360 no scope. We all know like the memes and the stereotypes. Like that's what CSGO is. So I get the vibe. If you're someone who wants a game more like League of Legends, where it's like people get punished if they're rude to you and people have to try and be polite. So Valorant is the game for that, and it's CSGO. So to me, there is a bit of a divide, but like I say, I do think like the battle really is the newer player. If all the newer players go to Valorant, it's not that they'll beat us, it's just that we won't have the same crop of talents. Like essentially, what will happen is you won't get SGW2K in our game, he'll be in Valorant, he'll be on like EG in Valorant or something, you know. That is a problem.
Yeah, so on the Valorant topic, because I even dabbled with it. I played it
a bit. Oh, you actually myself. Played it a bit, fair enough.
Yeah, I played a little bit at the very beginning when the game came out. I was kind of curious on how it played out. I do feel like now they have sort of managed to create a community of both players and viewers who are now distinct from Counter-Strike, but I do think they stemmed from it. I think Counter-Strike and I don't want to say the rejects, I think the word is too strong, but the people who either couldn't make it, have never made it, or couldn't make it anymore, went to Valorant, and then with the experience and the savoir-faire they had from Counter-Strike, immediately became way stronger than other people because the game is a copy-paste in terms of mechanics and what's happening, right? It's a bomb that you have to plant and defuse, it's a spike that you have to plant and defuse, whatever. The knowledge of Counter-Strike is immediately applicable to Valorant, which is why Existence and I, we had a whole lot of good time. You want to know a fun joke? You want to know a joke, Duncan? I made more money winning a tournament in Valorant than my semi-final at the Major.
What? That you were in some like massive cup or something? Yep. How much did you win?
It was like we won 20,000 euro for five people in a Valorant Cup. The maximum I made was 10,000 from a Major.
Yes.
And that was semi-final.
Yeah, there's the other thing, by the way. You know, when people talk about like the history of CSGO, and we do that thing. Well, listen, one of the real problems I've learned when I bitch about fans is these are things I would have thought incorrectly about years ago as well. The problem is once you see it, though, it just seems so obvious. So it's like a human failing in that sense. But one thing I will say is if you look at like CSGO, I always try to tell people that thing about like, if you were like JW, you had three majors a year, mate. By the time people like Simple Google, there was two majors. You know, already that's an advantage. You could win more majors, right? But another one is the prize money. Like people forget pre-2016, even though this is the glory era, like everyone loves 2015, that was when it was like a fifth as much at the majors.
It made nothing.
It was mental, innit? It used to be 100k for first place at a major, guys.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
That's for what first. It was. I know, but back to your point, just to talk about like Valorant and CSGO, right? So the way I see it, Valorant in how they marketed and positioned their game did a good job at grabbing way further than we did in Counter-Strike.
Yes.
Like younger people, they made sure, like as you said, some of these like social rules were applied.
Just in general, girls, et cetera, seemed to vibe with it way more. Exactly. Yeah.
And at that job, they were very, very good at grabbing massive audience towards them, right? And I think, I don't like the whole, I'm team CSGO, so fuck Valorant, I'm Valorant, fuck CSGO. That's how I look at it. I think it's a stupid point of view. I think you should look at what the other one is doing good and then trying to apply it for your own interest, right? So they did that, that's great. Now, the way I see it, one of the most important strengths of Counter-Strike is that it is a simple principle that has been alive for decades now, and it's working. The same with sport. Think about football, think about basketball. They haven't changed massively what it is they're doing. It's still a pitch, there's 22 players on it. Maybe the size of the pitch has changed, maybe the size of the goal cages have changed, whatever. Small details, the VAR came out, for the referees, that kind of stuff. But at the core, the phenomenon is the same. This is a strength that we have in Counter-Strike. We have a very uniquely defined identity as a game. People know what it is. It's very easy to understand for whoever doesn't know the game. Valorant, on the other hand, is much more changing with heroes, abilities, maps, and rotations. It's very sexy and attractive at first. You know, when you first hear about it, you're like, oh my God, wow, there's 20 different players and I have different abilities. And oh, it's got a flavor of excitement and new kind of experiences. That's great. It's going to grab a lot of people's attention. That's normal. Whether or not you can retain people on that kind of rhythm for years and years and years is yet to be determined. Counter-Strike has done it. We've done it. We've established we can become a decade-long game and we're going to have people to come to us. Valorant isn't there quite yet. But what I do think that CS2 gives us is a unique opportunity to sort of maybe take a couple of risks here and there and then grab the attention of other people who maybe weren't necessarily familiar with the game. And now it's a moment, right? It's a new game. It's CS2. It grabs people there. And then this is a moment where it's key, where I don't think we're going to have much more of that in the future, where we get to have a whole lot of hype and eyes on us, the way we're talking about. You're talking about the streamers who were episodically playing Apex or whatever going back. If there are people doing that for CS2, I don't mind. Good for them. You want to make some money a little bit and stream the game? Give us new eyes on the game. I know we can retain them. And this is why I think it's so important. I know Valorant now has life on its own, and it's great, and it should be there, and it's fine as an esport. But I do think that over time, the identity of Counter-Strike is much stronger and more firmly implanted. We're basically the only game that has now multi-generation interest. You could go to a tournament and you could watch a dad play and explain to his teenager what's happening, because they've technically possibly both at some point in and out have played the game. And that is something no one's going to take away from us. But we should seize this opportunity to just make a splash. Just make a splash. If it has to play by the rules of the mainstream media a little bit more, that's fine for me. Just grab a couple of eyes out there. Because once they get into the game, they're going to see the beauty of it. They're going to see the simplicity of it. And they're going to stick. But this is why I think it's an important opportunity in regards to how Valorant did their game and in what way they have been successful in grabbing some new eyes.
Actually, another thing as well, if someone isn't very familiar with Valorant, I'll say it's another reason I don't worry about the games as like being on some collision course or that you have to pick one or the other. Like I say, I think, first of all, they can both totally coexist. And if anything, I actually think it's more like if people, like I said, if they like the things about Valorant, like I said, like you can't flame people as well, I think then they're just going to stay at Valorant. And if they were on the fence, actually, maybe we can win them as they are still. Like, if they get the basics of the game down, they watch a bit, they probably have the grounding in it compared to a different game. But one thing that will always make CS have a massive advantage, in my opinion, is Valorant, because it's run by Riot Games, is way more akin to what they do in League of Legends with their circuit than it is the CSGO circuit. Like, I actually think the fundamental mistake they've made in Valorant is that, like, they still, like, basically, if you want to know how in League they envision it, it's because they don't use third-party operators, they don't use the ESLs of the world, they just do the tournaments themselves. What they do is, they always make what they think is a coherent internal circuit, right? And the flaw of doing this is, I would describe it as, they treat the circuit as if the circuit was the story, not the team and the player. And what I mean by that is, they've done this all the time in League of Legends. I've always found it so weird. They treat in League of Legends, when you watch like the LCS or LEC, they treat it like the show is what you watch, not the team that you like. Like, you're supposed to tune in at like, you know, 5 p.m. and just watch like 6 best of ones in a row of all the teams in the league playing. I've always thought that's such a weird, like almost antithetical approach to sport. Though, like, I could never imagine a world where for football in the UK we all sit down and then back to back watch all the team. No, you watch your team play, you know what I mean? Maybe like if there's a big televised game, the top two teams in the league play, maybe you watch that one because you're a general fan of the sport. But aside from that, in most things you watch your team play. And the reason why I bring this up is because it means they've taken a lot of the flaws of the League of Legends circuit and put it into their Valorant circuit. So in League of Legends, famously, you're divided up all the time. In CSGO, I always explain it like this. I might bitch about, like, you know, the 14th best team didn't make it to the major from Europe, Maniac. I'm actually being pretty spoiled when I do that. In games like League of Legends, if you don't know, only the top 4 teams from China, which is the best region, go for League of Legends to the World Championship. So if you're in, no joke, the 5th best team, there's actually one of the best players of all time is in one of these teams. If you're in the 5th best Chinese team in the best region, you sit at home for real and watch the equivalent of like Greyhound play the game. Like, I'm giving like a CSGO company here. You have to just sit and watch Greyhound play and go, oh, well, let's see if they win worlds instead of me. Now, that's actually not very satisfying, not just for players, but for the audience. Like, it means essentially you have to like pray that your teams are in the top 2 to 3 in their region. Then they go to the national. There's only 2 international tournaments a year, by the way, with the equivalent of wins. But imagine if there was only majors, guys, and then no Katowice and Cologne, and then no Blast World Fight, and it was just only Pro League, but regional. We're back to that. Like, that's not actually as satisfying for me, at least. A circuit, I like the circuit of the big tournaments. I love the fact that, like, every few weeks we go down to zero, then you feel that the first few days of the tournament, you get into the hype of it, you get hit the sweet spot where everyone's playing well, the playoffs comes, it's the top 6, semis, we're in the finals, and then we do all the narratives and we reset again, we come back. I've always loved that. It's like Formula One to me. You know, you go away, you come back a few weeks later, you're right back into it again. I've always thought it's a really compelling way to follow it. Valorant isn't like that. It's way more like League, if people don't know. Like, in Valorant, they have like the domestic scenes again, then the top couple of teams go to the international tournament and have that, but there's only a few of those, only like 2 or 3 of those each year. And so actually, in that sense, I actually think we're always going to have an edge as long as we have this third party circuit. Because as much as, I mean, we've been talking about this a lot on my shows with Maui Snake, as much as I like bitch about the majors, The brilliant thing about the majors is this. I don't like, for example, like the Swiss system and the fact that like they can't have double a limb anywhere. So, but the beauty of it is they still allow ESL to run their tournaments. So I can still, like, I even joke now, I don't want Claude to be a major because I actually prefer the current format. I think it's actually the best in CSGO. So I think that's still a big strength that people don't realize. You're not choosing between Valorant and that. If, in this sense, you're choosing between the circuit. Like, do you like our circuit? Do you want their circuit?
I'm right there with you, but I do think there's a point that we have to address, and I would love to have your opinion on it. When you have this sort of structured, story-driven calendar, as you mentioned, for League of Legends and Valorant, what you essentially do is that you artificially make sure that all of the region have a minimum of activity. Like you manufacture it. It's right there. If you're from America, if you're from Europe, if you're from Asia, if you know that your league, doesn't matter the level of your league, you're going to have a couple of spots guaranteed in the higher tier tournament. You funnel in a whole lot of motivation, talent, and possible eyes and investment onto your circuit. The problem of that, the downside of that, is that the level is a step below in terms of priority. The highest level of the tournament at the very end of the mountain is not your number one priority. You want to have massive activations. That to me is an issue, of course. I also, fellow ex-professional gamer, I like to have the best teams in the world ending up at the end of the playoff at a major. That's what I do want. But what we would have if we wanted to have it all, to eat our cake and have it too, or have your cake and eat it too, is that we would need to have organically activated regions all over the world without that circuit. And that's kind of the conundrum that I haven't solved. Of course, it's a harder piece to solve just right now. But if we could have regions actually being activated and alive and have a competitive environment on their own without forcing them into spots for the Colognes, the Katowices, the Major, that would be the best of both worlds.
Yes.
But that's what they ensure on their end. That I agree with you on the weakness of the end result of the last tournament, which is not something I want to. But that also keeps alive many, many regions who maybe otherwise wouldn't organically. And that's something that we haven't solved. And maybe something that CS2 could come in handy because of that little extra push of interest suddenly and more people start coming in. Profiles come out. You talk about old professional gamers like Wale came back in. Be like, hey, yo, CS2 is out. I'm interested. Like, I might have a role in this scenario. This could be something where we grab a bit more attention and sort of reanimate some of the regions, because that's something they did. All of the regions are alive. That's not the case for us. Not really right now.
Yeah, basically, if people don't know, the actual fundamental philosophical difference of what Riot did here is essentially in CSGO, if you like the circuit, you're like me, you're an elitist, you just want to see the top 20 teams play as much as possible and watch all the tournaments. But what they tried to do in Riot was the opposite. They tried to do the utopian dream of like, we'll do the grassroots, and then like you say, every scene. So if people don't know, there's even like a French league in League of Legends that's actually like pretty big. Like it has like legit viewership on it, and it has its old French commentators and teams, and they have imports and everything. So it's more like soccer in that sense. It's like a healthy regional scene. The problem is, I am an elitist, so like I say, I think the mistake they made in League and Valorant was they've essentially given too much to the regional scenes, and like I say, essentially you can just get caught in your regional scene, you can't get out. Whereas the example I always give is this: you know how in games like League of Legends, an eternal discussion is like, how can Europeans and Americans compete with Chinese and Asians because they're like just better at the game and they win more often, right? The real problem with that is, I always tell people, the sad thing is I know the answer, guys, because I come from a different game. You actually have to just give like cross-pollination. What you have to have is, even if the best European team isn't actually as good as the best Korean team, for example, familiarity will give you a crack at winning that game. And we all know this from CSGO, because think of teams who have like come, I mean, I'll even use the example of Greyhound to get the odd upset. If you actually look on raw level, if I had to do like, you know, fucking top Trump style maniac or like FIFA ratings of like the players, the Greyhound players, no diss to them, wouldn't be high up. They wouldn't be anywhere close to even some of the like the tier 2 EU teams that have like FPL players and stuff. But if they come and they play in the European meta 3 or 4 times a year and they get familiar with it, and suddenly when they play a Furia or something like that, it's not like, oh my God, Furia, but weren't they semis of the midget? It's like, oh wait, we played these last tournament. Once it's just a normal game, eventually you can get an upset. You can win that. Whereas the real problem you have in League of Legends, like I say, is you're just off in your region all year long, and then you just go to the World Championship. It's like, right, play this guy who's the best in the world from Korea. And you're like, I've only been watching him on demos though, you know what I mean? Like, you don't know what it's like to be in the cage with them, as it were. So that is the thing that would fix it. It's why you are really picking between the two. Like I said, I'm an elitist, so I just want the best competition. I mean, it's like you said earlier about the thing about how that's another thing about Counter-Strike again. If you're in Counter-Strike, you've almost philosophically chosen, you don't want a lot of novelty, you don't want new maps every 3 months, you don't want a new gun to be added to the game or the equivalent of a hero. I mean, dude, we lost our mind when they just added agents, which were just skins, because they just didn't look the same. Like, that one, they actually had real new characters, guys, that can teleport and shit inside Valorant. Like, so essentially, we have chosen. We don't want the league approach. We want it to be static, like we're talking about. And I've always thought one thing I do love about CS is why I am boring in my own way. Me and Lopez had a convo like this on Skype, no joke, in like 2008 or something. We both actually agreed to the same philosophy, which is, you know, when people say that classic line they still say to this day, Maniac, where they go, I mean, this, I'll use the old example from a few years ago. They go, oh, it's just bloody Team Liquid versus Astralis at every event. That gets really boring after a while. It's like, for you, mate, I'm a nutter. I've always said this. If you have like really great teams, like, I mean, last year it could have been Na'Vi and FaZe when they had that awesome rivalry. When you have teams like that, for real, I'm just like, lock them in a fucking room and have them play 100 times for the rest of the year. Like, I don't care, mate. I will watch every single one. I'll watch every VTOR to see what angle they do. I love that shit. Like you're saying, I don't get bored of it. I don't ever look at even the game. This is why I was one of those people who doesn't want to remove like Mirage, because I look at it and I'm like, you just want novelty, guys. You just want a fresh feeling. Like, I look at Mirage, I'm like, it's just a functional map. It's just a good map in the game that works for all sorts of teams. And so I'll watch that forever. Like, as long as it doesn't have like a bug that ruins the game, to me, that's like that would be like coming into a chess tournament one day and going, sick of this bloody board. Like, that'd be the one thing no one ever thinks about. Like, you know, you might like want to change your strategy or be annoyed with his strategy if some guy's playing the equivalent of like Jamie in chess or whatever. Like, you never come in and go, tell you what, what about 30 by 30? You know, no one comes in and does that concept. So I'm more like that. For Couch Strike, I do just like what we've got. I like the core product, and I actually don't want too much change. So to come back CS, Taylor, go on. You jump
in. I'm with you on that, because I do think for the highest level of esports, I'm right there with you. I'm a purist. I'm an elitist. I like the best of the best. I think we've already found somewhat of a very much working formula. That being said, 2025 with the whole normal partner, I have no idea what kind of mayhem we're gonna dive into. I mean, there's probably some smarter people than me who can figure out what the hell's gonna happen in 25. But I do feel like as a game, we've got it down to a T. Like the highest of highest level, we have incredible teams, great stories, great superstars. We have all of that. That's nailed down. I'm just thinking of ways to bring more people into the game so that the game can take another dimension, get even bigger. That's all. I don't believe that this is only happening at the very top, because I do think the top, it's set. It's beautiful what we have. Like, some minor tweaks here and there, but I wouldn't change. No, in fact, I don't even know what I would immediately change. Maybe a couple questions about format of tournament, but that's beside the point. What I do think we would need, and it's something that ESL had started doing with the Challenger, is the same as they do with tennis. The more viable and interesting environment you have below the very top,
right,
the more you can funnel new people who are interested in potentially making a living out of it, who can justify giving everything they have, investing their whole life into this without damaging what's at the very top. And that's what's happening in tennis. They have in tennis, basically, if you follow a little bit, they have different categories of tournament. They have ATP 250, 500,000, and then you have the Grand Chelem, which is obviously all the best players are, even, by the way, guys, invited. We all bitch about the invite. Tennis players are being invited and being put in a single elimination bracket to make sure that Djokovic never plays against Nadal or Federer doesn't play against Djokovic before the end. That's how tennis does it at the very top level.
Yes.
But what they do have over us is that they have a super healthy bunch, a legion of challenger tournaments, an ATP 250, where kids around the world, if they are fan of tennis and they want to make something out of it, there are plenty of different ways they can already make a living, and they can travel a little bit, get experience, get to meet a couple of pros here and there. Maybe one day you get invited, you have a wild card at a qualification for Wimbledon, you play one game, and that's it. It picks off. Like, it's such a good example of a circuit that's healthy and has both a very elitist format, top heavy, where the superstars are protected, invited because they carry the story, and at the same time they've opened the gate and they've made sure that people who want to get in are not gate kept 10,000 kilometers from the top. They are, and I think in Counter-Strike this is where we can do some work, because our very top is organized, our very top is great, we have such a good circuit already. But if we could do more to grab that people in this sort of purgatory, which is, you're not gonna roll in a Rolls Royce and have a penthouse in Los Angeles, you're not. But you can live off it. You can live your dream. You can be a player. You can make some money. And here and there, you have a chance at the top. I think this is where we could make really some big improvement in the game. And this is where we would kind of funnel way more people into the game. So I don't know, what's your take on that?
To me, that's also something where we have regressed because of all the online you-know-what bullshit from a few years ago. The main thing that happened was, if you remember, when we came back and we had the lands again, all we have is the top end door. That's all we have now. We just have, like, FaZe versus, like, Na'Vi versus Virtus Pro. Like, the real problem we have for me is, where are the DreamHack Opens? Back in the day, even a few years ago, we had something akin to what you're asking for, which is, because the sad thing is, I'll tell you what will prove it to people. Here's what you do. Pick a team that became really good in like 2020 and 2021 and go on their Liquipedia. And what you will find is, unless they're rare examples like Gambit Youngsters who were just a bunch of young kids who were just playing, if they're actually like established players like Forza and Fury and stuff, they were playing all the lands early. You just didn't notice them. They were at like a DreamHack Open and they went out in the group stage. And then, you know, then they lost in a semis against, I don't know, I'll pick like Imperial or something like that, when it had like Esperanto. Like, they used to be a fairly healthy tier two scene like this. In fact, if people don't know, some of the people from the teams now, like the Breaches, the Game of Legions, the Apex, they were all in that scene back then. All those coaches, they're not just brand new now. They haven't just joined, come out the womb today coaching some team. They were earning their stripes on like the tier two circuit. And the cool thing about that was, I even think it was akin, like you're saying, to how the ATP was. Because if people don't know, one of the beautiful things about the ATP is to some degree you have wiggle room as to which of the tournaments you play. Like, obviously everyone wants to play the Grand Slam. And in general, if you're healthy, you play the ATP 1000, which is the level just below, because those are the prestigious tournaments. That's the equivalent of Cologne, kind of eats in the majors, basically. But beyond that, you can actually pick and choose. Like for the 500 and 250 events, they have loads of them. And what you do is, some of it tends to be regional. Like, for example, obviously, if you're like from Europe, you might play the one that's in Spain and Basel and something like that. Like, you know, whereas like the American guy, I get if he doesn't go to all those, maybe he waits till the US Open circuit where you do all those little ones. And you can pick and choose to some degree. And you can also do it, by the way, to like in theory, you could in CS, but people don't consciously do this. You can also do it to manipulate your rankings. Like if you're this far off a spot, you can just go to loads of the small ones and sort of farm them and then get your points up to get to the next one. You can do that too. But basically, that's the real problem I see, is that I know part of it also is that ESL bought DreamHack and sort of just got rid of the brand. But like, that's what I see is missing. I know they're trying to do it with like the ESL Challenger, but to me, that's like, that's still a bit too high level, if you know what I mean. Like if you go look at the ESL, if people don't know, the last ESL Challenger final was Virtus Pro against Dents. It's like, that is tier one. What are we doing here? Like, those teams are mega. Like essentially, to me, that's like slightly too high for that level. I want another level below that. Because one thing I used to love back in the day was when you had the DreamHack Open, like I say, you also weren't just like nobody's at all was watching, because there would be one or two teams. There might even be like an early Vitality squad if they've just like formed, or an MSL's North team might go. There'd be one or two big teams you have someone to gun for and sort of try and beat. And the actual like tiering would be pretty good. And then, like I say, when you went to the bottom, at the bottom, you'd even have the teams that, again, now aren't anything, but one day they'll be interesting. Like the Bravado team from South Africa will be there, or I'm aging myself now, but the Renegades team and stuff, when they had the Australians, might be in the mix, you know. And that was actually like you say, it was something where you're not simple, you're not making 40k a month and you're not going to win a major, but you have an actual career, you have something to play for, and you have your own sort of part of the circuit. And I even thought the cool thing back then was, when if you actually could ever like fluke win one of those, you will get an invite to like a Katowice or something, like especially the one day with the playing thing, it would be a shoo-in. It would even work sense. So I agree with you on that one. That's the only downside, is because I had to learn this myself. Even though I would just choose like some elitist super league with the top eight teams and say fuck everyone, the downside of that is that would be short-sighted, because eventually I wouldn't have the talent in my super league, would I? They'd be all stuck off and they wouldn't develop. And the joke is I wouldn't get a Z, we wouldn't come along, I'd just be stuck with NES till the end of time, in my analogy. So I do agree, you do need something like that. Essentially, you need the pipeline to connect up, like the equivalent of analogy, to bring in the fresh talent, don't you? Yeah,
exactly. And the problem that we have, because we're making this comparison with tennis, which I really believe is a good example, the problem that we have is that they actually have a product, and I use product for the term tennis as a discipline, that is so strong that if there is two or three tournaments in Switzerland that are part of the ATP, hell, I love to go see ATP Gstaad. And I know the best one I'm going to see there is probably like a top 10 player. In fact, Casper Ruud played in 2021. That was great. I saw him there in Gstaad. The rest of the players were not that interesting from a story-driven perspective, but because I know tennis and I know the quality of the show I'm about to see, I'll go there. And so they have actual people and they have eyes on these shows. In Counter-Strike now, I'm not being an idealist. I'm realist. I know what it is. Who now is going to tell me that they have the budget to run an event with C-class players, which we're not necessarily going to watch? You still have to, have costs and expenses to run that down. So what we need is to find ways to make these tournaments interesting. And I think the gateway to Katowice, the gateway to Cologne, that's one way. Have one wild card per event where you invite maybe like a big team who accepts to come in here and do it as a prep or whatever. Hey, here is Vitality. They're playing the whatever challenger, wherever the hell in Europe. Here we are. Like, you have to find ways to make it a little bit interesting, because let's be real, we cannot just fill a small arena of C tier, D tier players right now. And so nobody really is going to do it because they're going to lose money of it. It's going to be just straight up running a wall. So the conundrum is kind of trying to find a way to make this sort of sub-level interesting and enticing for the fans and economically possible to survive. And then you have something going on. But we're not there quite yet. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I've solved the equation because I haven't. But I think this is where, like, if you suddenly find a way to make these less interesting, but like cost budget wise, sort of affordable events, then maybe you've just unlocked something right there. And that would funnel a whole ton of people. Just hashtag me on Twitter if you have an idea, because yeah, I'm thinking about it.
By the way, I've actually got a thing I want to run by you. Like, one of the problems is, one of my paradoxes in esports is, on the one hand, I'm actually a quite optimistic person. I do believe like everything's possible and you can turn things around, you can change things. But the problem is, that's like, if I think about me or like things I have control over, maybe. When I think about other people, I'm incredibly cynical and pessimistic, unfortunately. Hence, as you see with my journalistic work, because they just let you down and they don't understand things and they don't care and they do things for silly reasons from my perspective. So as a result, the problem is, I can think of like good suggestions, but I also then just think like, what's the point? No one will do it. So a classic one that people will know, I've mentioned this a million times because I come from the old school, is, you know, when people are having this discussion now about max rounds first 15 versus max rounds 12, and we need like these games to be shorter, but at the same time we need excitement. So the real problem is, there is actually an obvious solution to me. It's just, the problem is, it's too big a paradigm change, and it is to make it charges only instead of max rounds. So if people know that format from the old days, the idea of charges only is only the T-side rounds count, and it's a time limit based format. Now, the reason I bring this up is because, one, the time limit aspect would actually solve all these problems we're talking about. Because here's the other thing. You can change the time limit. Like, I think back in the day, it was like 20 minutes a half, because it was like just played one map, obviously. So like a 40-minute game was a good game. If you wanted to do a best of three, I don't know, you could tweak it. You could make it 15 minutes a half or 10. And the whole premise is, what makes it really fascinating is, it's because it's a format where only the T's count, only their rounds count. All you're doing is CT. It's like you're on defense. You're just trying to stop them score. So actually, not only does the time limit aspect mean you don't get games that last 3 hours unless you got really unlucky with overtimes or something, but it's going to be way less likely in this format. But also, it's a bit like, I mean, unfortunately, it's a bit more like American football, so a lot of people aren't going to know the analogy as much. It's more like the guy who's on the T side, the scoring side, you're trying to sort of like figure out, like if you're the first one, like you just played the beginning part of the game, you're just trying to get as many rounds as you can. If you're the guy who then swaps on second half, you're sort of competing against his score. Like if you know he got 8 rounds, this is what makes it fascinating. So actually, by the way, the other reason I bring this up is, even though I do think it's too big a paradigm change, I don't think it'll ever be implemented. The reason why it would be fascinating to me is, one, it solves the scheduling issue. But the other part that for someone like you would actually be very interesting, and a lot of the IGLs and the people who like the tactical side of the game, is it adds a whole new dimension. Because instead of having a set number of rounds and you just have to play that out, because of the time component and then knowing what the opponent did, if we're playing a game where you just got 8 rounds on Mirage, we'll give the example here, and I swapped to T-side, I now have to also factor in, not just is this a good tactic I'm calling, it's not set rounds, I have to do things like, right, how much time's left in the game? Like, if I don't have much time, maybe I can't do a load of Virtus Pro rounds where they're super slow, we break, because actually I won't have enough time to get the rounds to win. Maybe I have to up the tempo and do a load of like classic rushes and some crazy stuff, or maybe I have to actually say to my star player, just go crazy, mate, like we got. Or the other way around, maybe I only need 2 rounds, maybe you fucked up your half, and so instead maybe I am going to pull out Virtus Pro, maybe I'm going to try and just eke out like guaranteed wins with the crazy. So I actually do also think, if anyone could make the paradigm shift and they could sort of get it, because my biggest problem with this is, the reason I don't think it'll be implemented is, if you're a pro player, it just won't immediately feel comfy. It'll take you a little bit of time to sort of get in the headspace of how it works. Mm. And so unfortunately, I feel like you'll have an obvious incentive because you currently play the pro game and it suits you. You'll have a natural incentive to sort of dismiss it and be repulsed and be like, ah, it sounds too weird or something. But essentially, there are a lot of upsides. But as I said, here's the real problem. I wish I could actually present this as a real thing we should do. I just don't think people... I think it's a step too far for some people, you know. I think them, all you can change is the max rounds number. That's all we can do.
Yeah, I think it is. Look,
what do you think on this?
Well, when you were talking about it, there was like, I was going to say Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in my head. I had like a split personality. Okay. Like one side allowed myself to get dreamy a little bit about it, and I could see all of the tactical intricacies of what I would mean. And of course, like playing against the other half and having to adapt your play style to whatever happened in the previous half, which I think would be fascinating. Like we'd see so many different kind of skeletons of matches going on. No matches would be the same, and that'd be awesome. The problem is, I do think it's much too big of a step to take.
Yep.
And we have such an established format right now in terms of how the game looks like, and not only the pros, but the viewer, the community know what they're in yes. for when they connect into a game, that I think we'd lose people in the transition. But what I do think, what you're nailing, and I think this is a step that we have to, or a direction that we have to follow rather, is reducing the time. I think it is really key for our game currently. And this is coming from me, a guy who's played Counter-Strike for now 23 years, has thousands and thousands of hours and still loves the game to a T. It is coming from me. We have to reduce the time game for multiple reasons. One, of course, because it's hard to keep the entertainment of a viewer watching a game for 4, 5, 6 hours. It is hard to retain all of that people and all of their attention. Two, because from a production perspective as well, these are costs and there are variables that you have to handle as well. And whether or not we like to think about it, guys, this also, how healthy our ecosystem from a TO side of things is also is important for our yes. game. It matters too that the people like ESL and Blast know they can enter their cost when they have an event. That matters too to us. It might not be our first priority, but that does matter as well. So reducing time also means they can have a bit more control of whatever is happening, a bit less production costs and all of that. And hell, we have means now. Like, I know the MR15 to MR12, there is a little bit of a pushback, but I don't get why such a strong pushback. I know, look, humans as a whole, like we as a people, we are wired to be against change. Like that, it's very natural. There's this very natural psychologically explained situation where people like whatever it is that they like, whether it's good yes. or it's bad. People would say they much prefer something that's uncomfortable that they know rather than something unknown yes. that they have no idea.
I mean,
what
better the devil you know us, we say things.
Exactly, sure. exactly. So that's a very much a fact. And I think it's happening once again in Counter-Strike. Look, the first LAN I went to, I was 12 years old and I lost my first game 2:22 and I lost my next game 1:23. That was MR12 at the time. I went from MR12 to MR15. Of course, we could go back to MR12 or go to MR12 if you're a new player and you don't know around the block. It feels like it's a massive change and it feels like all of the cells in your body are telling you, no, we shouldn't do that. It's not that big a deal. We're going to adjust whatever our perspective on the game, and then rounds are going to get more important and there's going to be more stake riding on one round because now there is this clutch happening, and instead of 9-6, now it's 7-5, and it's a much stronger change because there is less rounds happening, which means the importance is higher. So as long as we make this change cleverly and we adapt the economical system of the game and we make sure that they aren't, this is a good change. It is good for Counter-Strike. It does not mean that we're going to play less interesting game. On the contrary, it's going to be more explosive. Any kind of crazy clutch or crazy multi-kill is going to have more emphasis and consequence because there are less rounds being played. So in regards to the whole game, it's going to be more important. We just have to make sure we do it right and we do it well. But we do need to think about it. Same with the smoke timing, round timing, bomb timing, freeze time. There are things to be done here. We can grab a couple yes. of key seconds here and there, make it a bit more of a faster paced game. And if there is a side of you that's a purist and you say, no, the game is how it is now, I don't want to change it, maybe it'd be great to open yourself to the possibility and think about what are the consequences of such these changes, reducing our playtime a little bit, get more out of it, get more passion out of it. There are a lot that we can do. And I think this transition from Go to CS2 is a perfect time to experiment just a little bit. It's a perfect time to see what we can mess with, what we can get away with. And we're not going to lose what makes our game beautiful. Like, we aren't. It's not the smoke duration. It's not the 155 instead of 145. It's not MR15 instead of MR12. That's not what makes our game beautiful. Our game will remain beautiful. So if you've worried about the identity of the game, I don't think you're looking in the right direction. We just have to be a little bit realist here. I'm trying to think, how can our game get bigger? Because I love our game and I want our game to get bigger, more successful, more people at it. And reducing playtime, I think, is an unavoidable situation. So I don't know what's your take on that.
I mean, it's like you say, what people don't consider is you don't even have to just change one variable. All of them are on the table in theory. I mean, part of it is obviously Valve has to sign off if you want to change for the major and all that jazz. But in theory, assuming they're open to it. Because as you say, there's a lot of things that people actually just assume. It's why actually everyone will have probably seen everyone was memeing on that G2 Valorant account, because the G2 Valorant account was like, lol, like essentially like, they're copying Valorant. It's like, we had my MR12 before you, you moron. The joke is you weren't alive, whoever made this tweet, like Zuma guy. He was like 17 years old. Yeah, you weren't alive when we made the change in 2003 to Max on 15 or whatever. Like, you think Max on 12 is brand new and Valorant invented it. It's the other way around. You've actually dunked on yourself there. But the bigger point is, people do take for granted those things that all have to be the same. Even though, like, for example, I'll tell you something that maybe modern day fans won't even know about CSGO. You know, in like 2016 was when they changed the bomb timer time. You remember this? It used to be way shorter.
Yeah.
Like, I remember even when they made it go up, because I remember doing like E-League when it had just changed. And the first thing you noticed was this has already changed the game. Like, people had all this time to molly out spots, like on cash retake or something. If you do like an A-site retake, you have like a million years more to check every box and throw a flash. And but before that, with the 35-second timer or whatever, like, you had to pretty much just go for it and tap the bomb really quickly and find the guy. It actually made the game, essentially, for people like Cole Zero and Crimson, made the game way easier. Like, actually, you have all this extra sort of real estate to work with, so you can change these variables, and over time, I mean, we can decide which is better, but the point is the game endures. Like you say, what you like about Counter-Strike fundamentally is still Counter-Strike, it's just slightly tweaked. So the real problem I have is this: it's when people are making that, is, oh, it's like a switch and you flip it. Like, we only have a choice, Max Rounds 15 as it is now or Max Rounds 12 as it is now. If that's the only choice, then I'm against Max Rounds 12, because I think it would have a lot of problems. Like, essentially, I think the mistake people are making is this, Maniac: it will be less rounds, but it actually won't be the rounds that you wanted taken out of the game, as it were, because with the current economy, it's the economy that's the problem, not the rounds. Like, the economy is even part of the reason why the fucking game never ends. Like, teams always have a buy of some type. Think how rarely teams ever do a real proper no buys, just pistols or like Glocks or that never happens now. Maybe like Virtus Pro, some super hardcore team does it, but like normal teams don't do that now. Now everyone buys a scout and one guy has a deagle with body armor. So like everyone does some level of that, because essentially you can always sort of buy. So to me, I'm cool with going MR12 if you do things like change the loss bonus, make it so that essentially you don't incentivize too much saving. Because the real problem is this: if you keep the current economy, people actually might save more relative to how many rounds there are. They won't overall save more because there's less rounds, obviously. But as in, they can't gamble as much. Like, people won't just do... Remember, we don't have the reset economy even. The other part people miss is this: a force buy was a massive gamble back in the day. But if you win, the payoff to the gamble is enormous. I mean, you should know. It's obviously the French scene is how they won the bloody majors. Like, that approach, it's like essentially high-stakes gambling. Because if you win, you break the other team, and then now they have no money. In the modern day, if they have, like... they've won a bunch of rounds, they have like 6k in the bank, yeah, you win the round and you get back in, but they still have their buy, and essentially the buys never end. Like, you actually have to like actually crush them economy. So yeah. I do think the problem is it's a bit more nuanced than people are thinking with just the raw number. I think, to me, you're asking this, I always ask this question, like, what am I trying to solve for? Like, what is the end goal I'm trying to get to? So the end goal for me would be, I want a lot of play in the game still, but yeah, I want the game to last less time. So the real problem would just be that, like, for example, I still think the number one problem with the game, maybe people can disagree, I think the number one problem in the game is what they changed in, I think it was in 2019 they made this change, if you remember. It was just the one where they changed the save money for the T's early in the game when they lose the pistol. Right, that, in my opinion, ruined Counter-Strike, where the CTs win pistol round, but you keep like one guy alive and the T's planted the bomb. Because you get those scenarios where the T's can now have a guy buy an AK-47, and maybe he does like a super soldier and gets dropped there. And he is basically more powerful a buy than almost anyone on CT side. Now, the problem with that is just naturally, when you then also don't, it's not just like, that's just a normal game, like a matchmaking game. I also then, remember, because you tease, you can choose who has that gun. Well, now if that gun is going to Zewu, Simple, it's game over. Like, I've seen this too many times, mate. I've won CT pistol. Like, I should be starting my role. But suddenly, the best player in the world just rocks up with an AK and armor and comes and kills the first three people. And everyone knows, if you're the CTs and you get broken on that round, bro, you could be like 1-4 down at that point in time. And if it's max rounds 12, we've almost done half. That's like half of the game. Like, all of a sudden, there is no time to get back in. You know, in the current economy, even if that happens, you think, right, we've got to like, we've got to stem the bleeding. They can't go up like 1-8 or something. But, you know, we've got to like win around here. And we can go back and forth, though. We've got a bit of middle room where we can get back in. And then at the end of the half, I've really got to come on strong. No, in this scenario, the second you get back from the getting economically broken and do like a hard save or a low buy, you essentially have to just win gun rounds from there on. If you don't, the game's almost over. And the other problem for that is, now let's go maps. Because if that's Mirage, that might be doable, Maniac. That's probably all right. If that's something like Nuke, fucking hell, you're going to have a hard time getting back in this game if you're down 1-4 and we're on MR12 and you're on CT side Nuke. Like, mate, you're already looking really dodgy for this map as it is. Like, you're going to have a lock, so you're sort of backs against the wall really early. So, like I say, I don't have a problem with it if you tweak some of the other variables. If we get the variables right, because essentially what we need to do, someone said it very well on Twitter. I forget who, I think someone from HLTV. I thought they phrased it perfectly, mate, almost like politically. It's not that you want to punish saving. You want to incentivize going for it. If you phrase it that way, I think you've got the right vision in mind. Now, I don't claim, by the way, also, that I know what would do that. I have some small tweaks I might change. But if someone has any good suggestions, I would be open to it. So essentially, I would just tweak some of the, like, the bonus stuff so that it isn't just like... Because what I really do worry about is people already saved a lot. And people like the VPs of the world sometimes do go ridiculous with that. So I don't want to see a game that is like 16-10, but it's like... You know, there was like fucking six gun rounds in it or so ridiculous. It can't just be one side battering the other. It's got to be real CS still.
Yeah, I agree. I think.
Do you have any concerns about some of that stuff?
You know, I think I share your concerns. I had a couple of thoughts that were popping through my head as you were talking about. First, just historically, for the newer viewer that are watching this podcast, so I'm really familiar with Counter-Strike. There used to be a time, guys, where you would rack up loss bonus as you would lose rounds, as we have currently. We have a four-step loss bonus. If you lose four rounds in a row, you max out, basically. But winning one round would reset that completely. So we'd end up in situations where you would be down 5-0, 6-0. You'd finally win a round. If you'd lose the next round, your half was done.
Yes.
Your game was almost done because you went from 0-6 to 1-6 to 7-1 against you. And you didn't have money anymore. You were right back to 1,400, and you had absolutely nothing. And these were the most important rounds, of course, very electric, very explosive Counter-Strike. But obviously, from a viewer perspective, that's great. But for the teams, it's annoying as hell. It also means we get less interesting rounds to watch as viewers. So this is what we messed around with at the time. And then they came up with this idea of kind of only one step back in the loss bonus so you can rebuy again. That's also kind of new. That wasn't always the case. And we didn't used to complain about it. I guarantee you, when you're playing best of one at the major and you're down 6-1, 7-1, good luck to you to come back into this game. This is what we had to deal with, right? Yes. So just for context. Otherwise, you were talking about the current situation with MR12. I agree with you. Some quick math. If you win the pistol round, you get reset and you aren't able to, again, reset your opponent, you could technically give away 50% of the rounds your enemy need on these halves. You could be down 1-3, 1-3. That's 6 rounds out of the 12 almost. You're there. So that's, to me, it's too much. That cannot be. It absolutely cannot be. We have to think about a way to make that less punishing because teams won't do it. Like teams won't either. I think it's going to take one or two roads. Either people will hyper focus on these force buys to the extent where we're going to develop an actual force buy meta, which is going to be the priority of every team. And this is where we're going to see the craziest strategies with fucking P250 or Galiz or whatever. Or people are going to be much more conventional and they're not going to put themselves in these risky situations. They're going to make sure they want to maximize the guns that they have. I don't think from an entertainment perspective, I don't know whether or not we're winning. That's a risk to me. But as you said, right now where we are in CSGO, prior to CS2, we know that it would be great to reduce a little bit the playtime and get the most out of it, so the quintessence of the game. But I feel like we sort of have a decent balance. So we have to fine-tune things in accordance to each other, right? We cannot just like change one button if you're like a DJ and you can just turn all the high to the max and the music doesn't make any sense anymore. We kind of have to keep that in mind. Like what we have is not far from perfect.
Yes.
Not far at all. So some of the changes that we do, in example, the MR15 to MR12, it doesn't just work with all the same presettings in the past. That just doesn't work. It means that things have to be a little bit adjusted here and there so that we keep sort of the balance that we have now while maintaining high intensity, high entertainment rounds and getting rid of the either full saves or people not playing the round because they're 3v5 and there's a minute 20 left and they're in T spawns. Like these are the things that we need to address. And I don't think, I agree with you. I don't think the economical system right now works with MR12. I think there's too much riding on a couple of rounds and people are going to be very conventional, probably too conventional about it. So this is why now, the period of time that we have now, and there's a whole lot of players playing the beta, I think it's important that they give that kind of feedback. Like Valve need to be aware that there is an issue here and that eventually it will have repercussions on how the top teams play because no one wants to be 1-3, 1-3 down when the game is MR12 and then you have only so many gun rounds where you can come back into the game.
I always felt like, unfortunately, that was one of the areas where to be an elitist, I did feel like a lot of casual fans didn't understand that old economy you're referring to, the hard reset one, because they would just treat it like, that's one of the reasons I even made a video, even in the modern day, about this concept, where the concept of the video was the scoreboard lies. Like, it's not the case that someone's actually down 13-8 and they have to ask questions like, what is the economy? What is the map? How many rounds are expected on T side? Like, there's a million factors. Like, what is the opponent's economy? Are they going to have safe for a round? Like, really, in that scenario, essentially, each round is not uniform. It's not identically valuable. It's not identically hard to win. And so in the old reset economy, I even think this actually used to fuck us as analysts a little bit, because the amount of times I saw people just bang on Yanko, where like the two sides of it were equally stupid. Either someone would have a game where they would win like narrowly on the scoreboard, like 16-13, or the other way around, maybe someone wins by what looks like a lot, like 16-9. If you're a casual fan, what you might not understand is that might be one gun round difference. That scoreline might be a single round, which means it could even just be one kill. It could be an errant flashbang. It could be a 1v1-1. But because of the way that economy used to work, if you're the team that gets broken when you were up 15-8, then suddenly they're going to be 16-12 if you win the game, you know. Whereas meanwhile, if you were the one who was the one up 15 and you won the round, it's over. You're going to win 16-8 or 16-9. Like in those scenarios, I don't think people understood how extreme the swings were. We used to often say on the desk that at that point in Counter-Strike, a map of Counter-Strike is more like, did you win the majority of these six key gun rounds, for example? Like, you know, let's say the six where we're on even strength and we have the weapons, or maybe I have an AWPer and my AWPer actually has the gun for three CT rounds or something. Like, really, that's what's going to decide if I win the round. It's not actually what I do in all the rest. And what looks fun to the fans, like when I'm doing a save or something, that's actually just like, it's just gambling. I'm not even really doing normal tactics on that. I'm just doing whatever I can to get a kill, can't I? Just some crazy stack or some shit. So it definitely, people take for granted. Bigger problem. I get the idea Valve does, mate. Like, the real problem I have is when everyone talks about going to visit Valve or talking to Valve at a major, first of all, as far as I know, the last few majors, they haven't even been around. So it's not like the old days. I don't even think people do the direct feedback. I know some people have sent emails about CS2 and have been obviously out to the offices to test it. But the vibe I get is this. That feels like those convos are on a very surface level about things like, well, do you like the sound, or what do you think of the movement or the graphics? I get worried, dude, that I don't think they ever have these convos about things we're talking about, like the economy. I get the vibe that never comes up. Like, Valve themselves don't seem to ever address that. I don't even know genuinely if they're actually aware. Like, I've said it on Twitter. If I asked them that question, Maniac, right, so in current CSGO, when we've got a problem with the economy, which is that if the CTs win the pistol round, but then lose the next round, and then if I said to the Valve dev, insert the rest of the story, what happens? What's the problem? I actually don't think they'd know what I'm talking about, mate. I think they'd sort of be like, what do you mean, though? Like, because part of the problem is this. I'll give them the olive branch, Maniac. The leeway is this, like I said. They're looking at just Counter-Strike, a game, as though it was just a game with 10 players who are faceless and you can insert anyone and it works this way. Like I said, the other problem we have is we're watching the best players in the world. So, like, I don't like that economy example I gave anyway, where the T's essentially can just force buy and have a better buy than you and potentially reset your economy. But it's made even more extreme when we put the outlier players like Simple into that equation. Now, he's going to completely break it, isn't he? He's too good. Like, everyone knows Zima with a fucking AK on the second round is going to destroy you if you have a farm ass. Like, it was already an unfair fight if you had an M4. You have a fam ass now and he has the fucking AK, like, and he has head armor too. Like, it's game over, innit? Like, we all just know that is an exploitation that works just every round almost. Like, not literally, but you know what I mean? It feels like it does. So that's the area where I just wish there was, like, it's why I've always said the real thing I only wish in CS, it's not even that they change anything. I just wish there was someone who was a community figure who you could sort of talk to. We couldn't even have on talk shows, etc. And whether they did it or not, one thing, believe it or not, I'll give Riot Games credit for. Everyone thinks I hate Riot Games. I do, for other reasons. But one thing I'll give them credit for, Maniac, is, believe it or not, when they changed League of Legends, they actually tried to explain whether it's a good or bad change or what they've done with the change, essentially. They sort of tried to explain it. Like, this is why we did it. We sort of buffed this thing to make it more powerful this way. And in doing so, at least you get a sense of what they're thinking. Like, I can accept a lot of things if I understand your reasoning why, but actually vice versa, even if it's something I don't dislike, it's hard to accept things when you have no clue what the person's thinking, though. You don't know what their rationale is. You don't know do they even care about the things, like, essentially think of it politically. Do you have shared values with me? Are we even fighting for the same thing? Do you, like, for example, here's the difference. If I found they just don't know at all, right, that's just it's ignorance. Like, they can be educated on this. We can talk to them. The real question is, do they like it? Like, if they like this economy, well, now we're on the opposite sides. Like, I don't. I sort of think there's some major flaws with what I think is CS. So that's the bigger issue for me, is, like, where is Valve's head at in it? Because, again, I get the sense they're more on the casual side. It's just my vibe from what I see, the messaging, you know.
So for the purpose of the argument, I did see them in Paris.
Oh, okay.
I saw a couple of them. They were here. They were physically present in Paris, and I exchanged a couple of words. That was it. In all transparency, I know that they exchange messages with some of the figures of the scene in the talent crew, for example. I don't really discuss with them too much. And I'm not going to say it's because of them. It's because sometimes I have this idiot idea that my voice doesn't really matter that much. So I'm like, why would I? You know what I mean? I play the game and I try to make the best with what it is. And whenever I have the chance, I will give my opinion. But I don't really have an open line of communication with them. But I don't think it's their fault. I think if I reached out, I might have someone listening to me, right? So I know that they have a couple line of communications established with some people in the scene. I think they do hear the concerns and what we worry about, but where you are bang on is that we have different perspectives. We have the massively esports elitist high level perspective of the game. And we get to see the best players in the world toy with these rules that they have made in Counter-Strike, and then we get to see the problems of these rules smack in our faces because guys like Simple and Zywoo would exploit some of these economical fallacies that you were talking about. That's for us, that's a very clear example.
Yes.
They also think of the whoever other millions of people playing the game and what it means for them. And there is a reality here. There is a disconnect where we try to meet somewhat in the middle, where it's like, yeah, we do understand the casuals and their needs are not exactly the same as Zywoo and Simple and the esports. But there is here a sort of a, how can I say it? Like a head-to-head or a problem, a confrontation, an obstacle right there, where we don't all share the same perspective. So they might have reasoning for why XYZ protocol is working this way. And for us in our world, it doesn't really make sense. But when you look down below at the sub-competitive or casual level, then it makes a little bit more sense. In extenso, hey, you would like whoever, Mr. Nobody playing the game to actually have the possibility to have a gun a lot when he's playing the game. It's not that fun to play with a Glock. Who would like to play a full eco with USP when you're trying to enjoy your game as a casual? It's not enjoyable at all. You want to have it be an enjoyable experience. This is where sometimes our words clash and where there is, I think, the necessity to have like a casual rule book and a competitive rule book where, listen, when I was a kid and I was playing football in the yard, we weren't playing 90-minute by the rules. You know what I mean? There was no referee making sure that we were calling our own fault and we were doing our own rules, right? We were having fun. That's normal. We were casual. And I think there is a necessity for like a separation here because, of course, some of their logic are applicable mainly to casual CS. And all we can do is say, listen, we understand that. But in our own world, this is what happens with these rules. This is the problem that we have. And I'm not going to say they turn a blind eye to it. No, I think they do listen to it. But it's never going to be a case of, oh, right, this happened in Navi versus FaZe, so let's make this immediate change. I think there are more concerns at a level below.
Because the other thing as well to me is I feel like sometimes they actually switch and they do that. Like, to me, I always thought the opposite version, like actually akin to what I'm talking about, but they went too far the other way, was when they did the original AWP nerf in 2015. Because here's the thing. Do you remember the way they messaged that? They even themselves, no joke, dude, when they nerfed the gun, they actually explained. I remember the terminology in it because it, to this day, it's just imprinted in my brain. They said they didn't want the AWP to be used like a mobile shotgun. On, right now, the reason why that's insane is because it only is like Kenny S and JW that were doing that. Like when they said that, they made it sound like literally like you're going in the pro game with an AWP and just dominating everyone. It's like essentially what the Krieg was, where it was like never wrong to buy it. And it was always the best purchase you could make, and everyone, and essentially it did like lower the skill level. Everyone was sort of decent with it, weren't they? Like everyone could sort of spray with that gun. I never really did think the AWP was that OP. Like, look, this take hasn't aged that well because obviously now if you put Simple and Zywoo with that AWP, yeah, they would be totally impossible. But back then, I actually thought they did go too far on that one. Like, if you remember back then, even, dude, some of the best teams in the world, like Fnatic and NiP, weren't even AWP teams. Like, the worst player would use the AWP, or sometimes they wouldn't even use the AWP and they still win the game. So I always thought, like, this is why this is another problem, by the way, we're just using that monolithic term Valve. Who the fuck are we talking about? Like, if you remember all the people back there, like Matt Wood and stuff, they don't even work for Valve anymore. They work in a different game. Like, the other problem with the whole Valve topic is just like in the scene, people cycling out, the devs cycling and out. Like, basically, there's like a couple of guys from the beginning of CSGO. As far as I know, a lot of the modern ones are like people who came in the last few years, and like it's just like a project they move on to. Maybe they historically like CS and then they start working on the game. So the other issue is we are also saying it like this is like the fucking Wizard of Oz and there's one person deciding it all. There isn't really. It's a changing set of people with the mask Valve on. And really the issue might be maybe the people I'm talking about when they did the opener, if it isn't even the people who do the game now, maybe the guy who does the game now has a totally different design philosophy. Like I said, maybe he wants it to be more casual, or he wants it to be more like, because I will say that's the other problem you have with this game. when me and you talk about the top end of the competition, we are talking about like chess, like the absolute best players playing the hardest version of the game. But at the end of the day, they also, Valve, are very cognizant of the pipeline of new players. And as you say, this is a problem that you're always going to have in esports. It's why esports is always going to have to change. It's because Richard Lewis said this the best way. In the modern day, you're not even just competing against like another game. You compete against all entertainment on the internet. Like when someone goes, shall I play CS2? They also, in their brain, are going, if not, I might watch this thing on Netflix, or I might go and play World of Warcraft, or maybe I'll play a game of League of Legends with my friend who is online. Like, that's his real choices. So actually, like you're saying, the real problem is this. I'm elitist. I would make it so, like, I would actually ruin everyone's fun. I'd be the Grinch, mate. I would take out all the OP pistols, SMGs. I'd, like, slash the fucking money that you get off them. I'd be so anti-fun. Yeah, because essentially I'm thinking of when you're the dominant team. I like it when, like, Quakestar, when you can totally shit on someone. You can just control them. But the problem is, you're never going to get any new players if you do my style. If you do my style, like we say, given a choice between go and play Valorant, where, again, it's like a game where you can essentially have, like, a deagle all the time if you don't know, or go and play a game like League of Legends, which is fun and it's more casual. The problem is the casual fan won't play my game and end up being simple. He'll probably go and play the other bloody games that are more casual and friendly. So to some degree, you do in the modern day, if you want the game to be a huge ease, but you've got some level of compromise you have to give.
Yep.
Now, here's the thing, Maniac. There are certain things in life, though, where you shouldn't have to compromise. Cute. There we go. I think everyone's strapping. We all know what's coming. So basically, what about bringing the heat, but not just like warmth, like a nice, pleasant heat. No, no, an infernal smoke occupying your lungs for as long as it must until the effect is achieved. You have to put up with it just to get that like effect of getting high, don't you, with cannabis? Coughing and wheezing. It's horrible, isn't it? That unpleasant occupational hazard of the cannabis connoisseur until now. I'm too good at this bit. Heralding a new era of smoking. The adjectives of this age are smooth, cool, comfortable. Smoke, yes, but it's cooled. It's not irritating. It's not biting in that same way. With the same great THC effect you're used to from smoking, but without the downsides. So this is a quality of life upgrade for you or the smoker in your life. The freeze pipe uses its food safe glycerin chamber. You take out, you put into the freezer section for an hour. It comes out, it cools smoke by over 200 degrees. Obviously Fahrenheit, Americans. Calm down, Europeans. It's like, what would it even be if it was over 200? And so, I know, like, you don't like actually end up like in Antarctica or whatever. Basically, then you just get like nice cool smoke. You don't have that annoyance, do you? So if you want to use this, go to thefreezepipe.com and use the code LFN for 10% off your order. Thank you for supporting the Freeze Pipe and Last Free Nation. Right, okay. One thing that we can swap to now, Maniac, is I actually want to know, you're someone who likes to set your imagination free. Are there things, bigger picture, that you're looking to see in CS2 that might be different or we could improve? Like, I'll give you an example. One thing that I actually think is very topical for how CSGO ended. You know, when you saw all these tournaments and people were saying, if you look now, we almost may as well get rid of the flags because all the flags are just European. It's just the EU flag, isn't it? Whereas, you know what it was like? Dude, we didn't even have international teams to like the equivalent of what was G2 and FaZe. And then even then it was like, there would be like the one big one. Famously, Mouse was always the budget FaZe where they were trying to do it on international. There would be like two or three in the mix, or maybe you'd have one where it was more like, you know, the Australians know they're not good enough just Australia, so you bring in a Jacob, you bring in a Naf, and you have like a slightly international team. Now, the one thing I'll give a big props to CSGO for, and this is one thing very different from my native game of CS 1.6, is in theory you can be from almost anywhere. Like, it's still going to be hard if you're from China or something, but almost any like European, South American, or North American country. If you're from one of those and you're actually like really good at the game, you can have a pro career. It's actually a really cool thing. So I'll give you an example that was making me think of this today. You know, when you log into Liquipedia and they do that thing where it's the birthdays and it's for people who won tournaments like in the past. I saw there was a tournament that was won back in 2010 that I went to as a journalist, that my boy Valet was there, where SK Gaming won the European, like some World Cyber Games used to have a European equivalent of it that could qualify you, right? SK won the European equivalent of that over MTW, the Danish team. And the story isn't going to be about any of those players, all the ones that you know, Valet and Robban and Trace and no. What happened was at this tournament, there was a team from Czech Republic and Slovakia called E-Super. And they had a bloke there. You ready, Maniac? He was only about 19. He was called Oscar. And he was playing. And this is what I'm going to make the point of. Because this is the end of 1.6. It was 2010 in 1.6. It only lasted until 2012. At the time, I was a nerd, so I'd already seen his frag movies and watched some demos. And I remember asking the other players, like the SK players and the MTW players, like, is this guy actually good? Like, I've heard he's like really skilled. And they were like, oh, he is, like in the scrims, like he actually looks like he's insane. But of course, it doesn't matter because we're going to beat their team. And they did, they thrashed his team. Like, it was easy. And at the time, you didn't have international teams. You had the rare example, like Lopez when it played EG or something like. But Oscar didn't have the profile for that. Like, no one would have come and scouted him. It's not like now with FPL. It's not. Basically, you think of the people like the Sphinxes of the world, the Nikos of the world, like even Oscar himself, because of CSGO, Oscar actually had a pretty cool career. He sort of got like the back end of it. He got to be a pro in majors, like win tournaments. Like this guy, I've always said this, the real tragedy in Counter-Strike, if we'd have stuck with how 1.6 was formatted is, that's what Nico would have been, bro. He would have been a guy who went to a regional tournament, fragged out on the losing team, came like eighth place. Maybe if he's lucky, some famous Swedish player went, he's pretty good actually. But anyway, on to the final. And you know, no one would remember this guy. The cool thing about CSGO for me, and so I'm looking to CS2 for this, is we have gone full Dota now. Like essentially, as long as you're European, all the teams are mixed now, mate. Like, it's only the ones that are essentially, like, let's be real, it's only teams that have insane team play that don't switch. Like, as far as I can tell, the only reason you don't feel like a heroic is because it probably would be a downside to you to bring in, like, a more skilled fragger like Sphinx, but ruin all your dynamics of the team. Aside from that, everyone's in a EU team now or an international team. So the upside is, like I say, now it's not about you better be born in Denmark or you better be in an NA team earlier. Like, if you're actually really good, I mean, you can see this with Flames and Sphinx and all these guys coming through. If you're just really good, mate, you can actually get around everything now. I mean, the craziest thing to me about the whole Israeli angle is they even have that thing where you're going to sometimes have visa issues, or certain countries might have the same rules as the way they can come. But if they're that good, we'll make allowances for you, basically. And obviously, if you're someone like Nico, you can just come right to the best team, mate. Like, it's not even like you just get to have a career. You can just be in the best team and be the best player in the world. Like, I think that is actually pretty sick. So I wonder, do you have anything like that? Is there anything for CS2 that you want to see happen? Is there something, it's some way to expand the game or something you want to see happen?
Wow, it's kind of rough because...
Like, are you a guy who wants to see the old guys still good? Do you want to see them? Do you want to see, like you said, the tabula rasa? Do you want the board to be completely reset? And then maybe, like, Nico's just okay and some new rifle comes. What's your desire for the game?
So I would like the game to be still very, very high in terms of skill ceiling. Like, it's okay if it becomes a little bit more noob-friendly. That's all right, to an extent. But I would still like for a few selected individuals to have extraordinary performances that we cannot touch. Like, I think it's very important. I wouldn't appreciate if the level or if the skill was leveled where suddenly Simple, Zywoo, and Nico don't look that impressive anymore because of some mechanics that came around and then some other people can do what they do. That would be a tragedy. Like, any mechanics that level out that kind of extraordinary performances is unacceptable to me. I don't want any of that. Now, some of these improvements that you mentioned in CSGO and how it became international and we had all of these pipelines for talents, I feel like it's kind of hard to do something new in CS2 that would replicate that. I feel like the major changes have happened in CSGO. We have now, we're far away from this, again, pipeline where I am the best player in Switzerland, but because I don't know anybody, no one is going to ask me to play on their team, which means I'll forever be the biggest fish in my very, very small pond. And whenever I get the chance to play against the best teams in the world, it feels like they are playing a game. I don't even know what that is because we're playing so far away from what they're doing. We're far away from that. That problem has been solved. The only or one of the steps that we could do, and even though I appreciate the FPLC, FPL ladders, and they have already done a whole lot of good for the community by allowing certain players, the Robses, the Sphinx, hell, even the Zywoo at a time, to be out there and be known and be recognized, that's great. If an actual built-in game leaderboard had some value to it and people had a way to just grind points and become visible for everybody without needing the connection.
As in more equivalent to like League or Dota or something.
Exactly, or Overwatch, for example. Right. You can be in Overwatch, you can be ranked number 12 as a DPS, and it doesn't matter if I don't know the pro scene. I'll see your name and I'll be like, hold on a minute, who is this guy? He's 12th best Genji? What the hell's going on? And I'm going to have interest. If you can facilitate a way for people to put themselves out there as having exceptional numbers, exceptional rating or KD or whatever that is, then I'm all for it. Anything that facilitates an individual to prove his value and get eyes on him, it's great. But I don't think we're so far away from the base case scenario already. we have plenty of different pipelines. Hell, the streaming in itself is also a way for people to get other people to know them and notice them and maybe possibly invite them in their team or trial them and all. In the international versus national conversation, I think we're way past the Rubicon anyway. It's been crossed a long time ago. Yes. We are fully international. There's a couple of teams out there where maybe it's more of a like linguistic approach we should have, because linguistically speaking, the language is too far away from English, so the bridge to gap is too far. And so you're sticking with Brazilian because how Brazilian is, or you're sticking with an Eastern language because it's too complicated. But if English is very comfortable to you, why would you even limit your pool of talent you can come in? And Heroic, I think Heroic and Astralis are pushing the envelope because they have such a strong national scene, they don't feel the need. But eventually, my take is that we'll all end up being fully international, very likely. Like if you could push in like 20 years, I mean, I still think the top is going to be only made of international teams because people will look to have the best with them. Doesn't matter what language you speak, English kind of levels out all that. So I wouldn't even know. Maybe, look, if we can have a couple of influxes of old figures coming back in the game, but more in staffing positions or coaching positions, helping positions, that'd be great. I wouldn't like the game to be so easy that Wale can come back and be good again the way Valorant leveled out the level, because I became relevant after being retired for months. And I came into the game and it was the skill ceiling was so low at the very beginning that automatically I was one of the best. I don't want any of that in CS2. I want it to be as hard and as strictly defined as CSGO is right now, just even better. I wouldn't want any of that. But I probably lack a little bit of imagination here, because I wouldn't know what I would like that is so special. I guess in my mind, I don't really see it as such a new thing. I just see it as a better CSGO, a more modern CSGO, and an opportunity to get a whole lot of hype about this game and grab some people that weren't really aware of the game before. But all of the improvements and the progress that we've made with CSGO, we should retain them. And I don't think there is any reason we would stray away from that.
I'll give you an example of something I do have a concern about in CS2, which, as you say, is basically just CSGO with Switch. It's more of a scene issue than an actual like CS2 specific one. And it basically goes like this. I actually worry a little bit that in the post-online era, where, as I said, a lot of the veteran, like OG, very skilled or good players sort of like let their game fall apart. And some of them just didn't ever have the motivation to come and be good again. And they just faded out of the game and they've gone and they got replaced. I always say, first of all, in terms of star power, you can't plays Kenny S. Like, I always tell people this. Kenny S and Scream are the best example ever because they haven't even been relevant players for 3 or 4 years or more than Kids of Scream outside of Valorant. But those names are just so injured. That is like Achilles and Hercules and shit, if you don't know, guys. Like, the new player, like, Zewu's better than Kenny S now, but it doesn't matter. Like, he still hasn't got the, like, the difference is some kid in India knows who Kenny S is, who doesn't yet know who Zewu is, I'm afraid, because he doesn't watch the pro scene. It hasn't, like, percolated out through the culture in the same way. So essentially, what I'm going to get to is this. I think a complaint I always told Americans they had is, I've always said this, European people, when they trash talk, try to make it sound like it's that the European players are better. I've never thought that. I've actually always thought NA had some amazing gamers. I mean, you could just look at people like Twists and Delige. Their mechanics are as good as you want, mate. Like, they could clearly, if they were on the right team, they could be the best player. They could be the MVP, of course. The real problem I always thought the NA scene had was, they had, like, I mean, you know, in America, they even used to call the games not tax shooters. They called them ego shooters, remember? That was like the term for like Call of Duty and stuff. That is the vision I have of how Americans saw the game. It was all about how skilled you are. And a lot of their lineups were just stacking skilled players. If you look at the lineups that have had success in America, Team Liquid, NRG, Cloud, often it was just stack as many skilled players as you can, and then after the fact you sort of figure out how we're going to play, what style. And if you had a team like with a Stewie 2K type player, you're probably going to play quite loose, you're going to play quite poggy, and you're just going to go off skill, and you're going to headshot people with a deagle and try and overrun them with rifles. You're not going to be playing Astralis 2018 style. My problem I always told them was, your scene's sort of only selecting for the really skilled aimer. You're trying to get all these really skilled aimers, and then you just tell them, basically almost like when we're kids and you play football, like, well, we're going to be the strikers and you're not good enough, so you have to be the defender. You're almost doing it like that, where, like, the guy didn't choose to play that role. You just tell him, essentially, you're the anchor because you're not good enough on our team, right? My concern is, I always thought the edge Europe had was, we had some amazing players who willingly chose those roles, or who, like, the team decided, like, the classic examples are people like NBK. They could have been among the stars and among the people competing for the MVP. But actually, if a player like that chooses to sort of sublimate his ego and become an anchor or like a, or just like the guy who plays the worst spot of the entry position or something, it's just going to make your team so much better. So essentially, the concern I have is this. I feel like the whole FPL and stats generation of just looking for like who the next, like, you know, the thing where now everyone's obsessed with the Donk guy, like he's the next like Dexter for them or whatever. And then it, there's always these players that come along when they're breaking the stats, right? And everyone wants that guy. And then even when you have that guy, you want to put him with like, then you're going to put him with like Flit and then with this guy and say, these are all too many of the same player for me. So the main concern I have is I really hope that we're not going to go too far towards like the idea of stats and skill, because even though I won't like belabor the analogy here, it's not quite the same as sports, because in sports, since you have substitute positions, you want veterans there just because they can sit on the bench and help your players, right? Obviously, you still have to be able to play the game. We haven't got a free spot in a five-man team. If you're going to be an active player, you have to still be able to shoot people and do the basics. But I do feel like people are overlooking that people like the NBKs of the world. That's probably an extreme example now because he might be at the end of his career. But the difference is if I've already got the players who have the sharp aim in my team, sometimes I don't want another good aimer, but who's playing on off roll. I want a guy who's like his skill set, like Crims for so long, is like he's an all rounder, or he's got like a sort of an understanding in the game of other things than just fragging. I mean, the best example in the modern day is probably Magisk. I don't actually think Magisk has like bonkers mechanics compared to some of the other players. But the reason you would think he does when you watch him in Vitality is, man, his game sense is fucking amazing. Like, you can't teach that even, bro. Like, some of that, like, I mean, I remember when this guy was on Dignitas, he wasn't like this back then. He was just a sharp player. He had nice aim and super sick spray, and he could use the Krieg when no one used it. But like, he wasn't this player. Like, this player he is now is the one he became in Astralis when he became this monster player who won the MVP of the major. Like, I worry that essentially people overlook that sort of player, and they really do think it's all just about who is the young, like, Flames hot aimer, and we're just trying to stack as many of those. Because if we do that, that will actually, as to me, it's not just like I just want these people to have a career, it'll be a bummer. Like, part of what makes Counter-Strike beautiful to me is that type of a team balance, where I can have like a young player like a Nerds or something, but I've got to offset them with like, I mean, the Snappy, you know, example is a bad one because he's an IGL, but like, I've got to have a veteran player that sort of anchors me down a bit and brings some of the other quality. What do you think on that? Because the problem essentially I'm getting to is, it's easy to pick out the skilled guy. You can look at stats. You can watch him in an FPL game. The players I'm talking about, you have to sort of, it's like scouting. You have to do your homework. You have to ask around the scene. You have to maybe even play with them. But in my opinion, when you get the good ones, it's why I think Perfecto is so amazing. I think they're worth their weight in gold if you find them, mate. Like, once you find that player, like, there's not many of them. And what they bring to your team is, it can even be more valuable than fragging sometimes, you know, sometimes.
Yeah. I think you're making an excellent point that I was not even considering myself when I talked about the stats, because I was more thinking of that research of the 1%, right? That research of the 0.001%. There's a couple of angles, a couple of ways I look at it. The first one is top down. I believe that the professional players of the scene right now will maintain a tradition of cherishing these role players whenever they find them. I do think that teams at the very top level are aware of how important it is to have a Magisk, to have a Perfecto here and there, to have an Electronic, and not just be looking for the guy who's going to drop you 35. I do think that there is a knowledge, and that knowledge is not going anywhere because, again, the professional players are aware of some of the roles and how important they are. So from top-down perspective, I think they will be the guardians of sort of these roles. And for a team, in order to work, they're going to keep trying to find these profiles. Now, bottom down, or bottom up rather, that's going to be more complicated. All of these FPL or any kind of ladder will not reward role players. Not at all.
Yes.
And funnily enough, this is where, for as long as the critics go, League of Legends and Valorant have solved that problem, because they have actual roles. So you can actually be an excellent support. Yes. You can be an excellent support, and that is it. You are the best at your role. And although the stats won't have you up as a superstar, everybody will agree that, hey, this carry has this support behind him, and these duo is amazing, and that's what they do, and that makes them special. We don't really have that in Counter-Strike. In Counter-Strike, it's more organically. Like, we organically celebrate a couple of the supports or the anchors of the times, your Creams, whatever, your Sunny when he was in Miles, your NBK. We celebrate them organically because of how great they are. But no one would do it for them. Like, I think the voices of the community, the teammates, obviously the pundits, the analysts, we have to put them out there for whatever it is they're doing, and we have to celebrate them to make sure people understand that. That is very complicated to manufacture. I think what is important, if we want these players to be able to be found and not be kind of drawn out or leveled out in the whole skill jungle, is to have tournaments at the sub level that are important, because tournaments at below level will allow some of these players to be found. Like, this is what sort of happened to me when I was playing Source. I was strong skill wise because from 1.6 to Source, I suddenly found myself in a comfortable position. Sure, but it's like the only reason Varygames talked to me is because I was a B anchor. They were looking for someone that had that role, and they were looking for a few qualities that I was displaying at the time, and they got interested. But that's because they saw me play in a team, not just pugging around and having fun and running. They saw me play in a team. They saw how I was playing in that team, and they applied to it. And I think the comparison also stands here. You need to be able to see a player in a team, in a specific role, in order to know that he's going to be doing great as a whatever, entry fragger, as an anchor, as a sniper. That, I think, the team play aspect of Counter-Strike is what's going to protect these people. And I don't really know how we can make sure that still is the case, rather than make sure that there are a few of these tournaments where we get to see people in action, in context, play Counter-Strike, not just running around and having sort of whatever, 26 kills and being plus 10 in stats. And I went, oh, this guy, yeah, he's definitely the best player in the world right now. Now, we also need to have, I wouldn't say role players in the sense of, hey, nowadays a player in Counter-Strike is only knows how to hold B-side. Of course not. We've come to a point where everyone is so strong that you need to be able to be versatile and need to be able to entry in different situations or whatnot. That is still the case now. But you still have to have moments where people can play in context. And yeah, I think we should be careful with that. You don't want to level that out. But I believe that the pro teams and the coaching staff and the leaders of this world in Counter-Strike will remain aware.
At the top level, yeah, they definitely get... here's the difference. Yeah. They know what they have, essentially. I agree with you. Because, like, for example, I'll give a good modern example. If you ever talk to the people at Ents, right, everyone who looks at stats and highlights is going to go, whoa, Sun Pius, like, holy shit, nerds. They all rave about Dekar, mate. That's the player they all think is, like, Madden. Dekar and Madden are the ones they all tell you about. Because they tell you, you don't know what these guys do for the squad. And, like, you know, they create space. And essentially, they're setting up the structure that allows those other two to carry. I'll give you a modern day one, because if people are watching Pro League, they'll probably have watched this team recently. Even though Sun Pius left Movistar Riders, Movistar Riders is still a cheeky dark horse team, aren't they? But if you watch them play, if you look at the stats, you're going to think, right, who's the next Sun Pius? You're going to look, right, the Martinez guy basically replaced him with the AWP. And then the other guy who always has the good stats is the guy Alex, right? Right, if you just go for stats, those are the players you pick, and then you leave the others behind. Dude, if you ever watch Movistar Riders play, the player you want to watch is a guy called Mopoz. This guy is a mega impact player. He's like a really aggressive player. Basically, like, he's like the player who, like, is the wildcard element. You just put him into the squad and he's going to, like, entry, create action on the map, like, do aggressive pushes. Like, that's an example of a player where on the stats, he's going to be up and down because of his style of play. He'll have one tournament look shit, one tournament look good. That's an example of, like, the sort of player I say where, like, you're not going to have an article on HLTV, like, one for the future. And, like, essentially, he's been and gone. Like, unless you see what it is and you want that in your team, you're not going to get it. If you're just looking at stats, you're going to recruit the AWPer and hope he's better than your AWPer. So what I would say is, I want to spin it and ask you this. Since we have certain topics we have never discussed, I have never asked you, and I'd be interested in your case, because I would have defined you as one of them. What do you think on that whole topic, which has become like the eternal debate, but like most debates, I mean, I think it's just poorly set up, of do you actually envision the game as there are things like support players or supportive elements? Because I know a lot of top pros, actually, I will say mainly stars, I know famously Snacks came out against this, they have a different vision to me, Maniac. They actually think of the game as like, you like sort of just raw competence for all roles. Like, they think that like every team should just be actually good players and then everyone can figure out their role, as it were, which I actually think, I mean, for me, I think they're being a bit too idealistic, personally. I want to know, where do you come to that? Are you someone who sort of sees the game, either it could be in terms of resources, if you want, it could be a specific role, an anchor on a map or something. Do you see the game as like, this is a different role, it's a different skill set? Where are you at on that one?
I think I have a little bit of an in-between view on it. The way I see it is, there are different qualities in players or different characteristics in terms of personalities that will allow a player to shine in different places in the game, right? I'll give you an example. One of the reasons why I was a decent enough anchor to be able to have a career at the top level was because I'm a patient person and I can handle the last 30 seconds. I can handle it. Like, I can sit in a corner for a minute. I can listen to what's happening. This is working for me. That's fine. A player like Apex used to be the polar opposite. Sure. Very active. And I mean, we laugh about it because it became a meme by the time, but super active, always looking for frag. It would be ridiculous for him to be in my position on the CT side. That, I don't think there's any way to make it go away. I think there are different positions in the game on the CD side and on the T side that will require to be a bit more passive, a bit more patient, or a bit more proactive and risk prone. To an extent, I think as a team, you need to be careful of that and you need to make sure that you optimize whoever is doing what. That's the baseline. But beyond that, there's two ways I look at it. One way is, I think for a while, players were using roles to justify their lack of performance. And I was one of them when I was playing.
Okay.
And you're lying to yourself. You are lying to yourself. You can pretend like your stats are in the red because you're playing as an anchor position. There is probably a little bit of truth to it in terms of the amount of duels that you have. But I also think it's sometimes it's a cover up to avoid yourself looking at your own limitations, right? I think that's a problem. And if players do that, it's going to limit them more than anything. Now, at the very, very top level, no matter the role that you play, during a round of Counter-Strike that has become so deep and so profound in how the rounds are going, you are being asked to entry, clutch, retake, flash for a teammate, ask for a flash. All of these you're being asked to do in a game. And whether or not you're capable of doing them will be the difference between you being just a whatever role player in the sub-tier Counter-Strike or you making it to a very top team. Because this is what we ask of now, the top, top level. Anybody is supposed to be able to clutch. Sure, we have the odd characters here and there. We have the expert, right? We have the clutch expert. We have the entry experts. We have some people that truly has a singular relation to the game. And I don't think it should go anywhere. I think it's beautiful that we have some expert in these areas. But everyone is supposed to do it at a high level. This is the game. So the concept of roles kind of dissolved for me in the Counter-Strike now compared to 4, 5, 6 years ago. The roles dissolved. You still match people in terms of characteristics and what is hoped or what is asked from them to deliver in the game. You have to match it because quite simply, you're managing a pool of 5 players. And if someone is feeling a whole lot of frustration, it's not going to work. So as a leader and as a coach, your role is to make sure that a little bit like a job environment fit, like we use in psychology, you have to have a job environment fit for the players that you put in positions. Otherwise, people are going to be eternally mad and angry and they're not going to deliver. And there's going to be turnover. They're going to leave the team and they're going to get kicked. You have to have a match. That could be sort of phrased as a role, I guess. It could be phrased as a role. I wouldn't be against it. The same way aggressive players will love to be put in through smokes with flashes. But you have to be much more versatile now than it was the case before, where I could argue, hey, I'm never in an entry kill because, you know, I'm a passive anchor player. That's not the case anymore. It's much more versatile. So, yeah, it's kind of a Swiss answer, but I think, like, reality is probably in between right now.
No, I know what you mean. Like, the other thing as well is, like, it's a bit like why there also isn't a hard entry role anymore, hence why even Apex didn't do it. Because the other thing that was silly was it ended up actually sometimes being reductive and restrictive to have that role. Like famously, if you're set up on T side of Inferno and you spread out across the map and you have a couple of people holding at the top of Banana and you have the guy in Boiler, if you decide to pivot and suddenly go A, you're not really going to call Apex back from the top of Banana, wait for him to come all the way around and then go, now go on to, like the joke is the rotation for you will be longer than the bloody CTs at that point. At that point in time, even if it's Happy who's holding the Boiler, he's now the entry for this round if we're going in, because logically he's the fastest one to get there. So I agree, there is a bit of that. So to some degree, you have to know, like, essentially you have to have some degree of competence at some of these things. But the other way I do it as well is, because I've updated my thinking over the years. Before, I used to think of it as more like you have a couple of players who are doing these spots. I don't think the spots exist as much now, but I describe it more as like there's only so many resources in the game. I mean, there's only so much money to buy guns for start off, but also, like, I consider a resource, like, whereas in League of Legends stuff, it's like farm, obviously, and items. I consider another resource in Counter-Strike space. Like, there's a question for me. Instead of supportive or, like, carry, it's, are you the one who creates the space? Are you the one who has the space created for you? That's an interesting discussion, too. Because essentially what I'm getting at here is, you obviously can't have an IGL and 4 people who get all the space created for them. Like, he's only one guy, and he can't do that for you. So in the team, you're already going to have to balance it out in that regard. It's why, actually, I think some of the super teams fail, even if these players in theory could play the roles. It's like, at the end of the day, that would be like having a football team full of strikers. It's like, mate, even if they all can score, Eventually, you want a midfielder that's going to cross the ball in, or a defender that's going to get it and hold it and bring it up the middle. Like, you don't just want 10 people trying to have shots on goal. It wouldn't work, would it? So, to me, resource is the angle. But the other angle you bring up as well, that I think is another one that I had to learn myself. I was being too much of almost the guy looking at the numbers and thinking it was a machine that you could just insert people into. My biggest mistake was not understanding, both in terms of personality and playing style, you have to have a balance to a team. So, like you're saying, the reason why in your teams, for example, you and Apex can exist in the same team, it's because, as you say, you have almost polar opposite tendencies. It actually balances each other out. Like, essentially, if Maniac actually does do a good job patiently holding an anchor spot on it, we'll just use a random example, like B Mirage or something, that means maybe Apex can do some crazy pushing Palace or something like that. Mm-hmm. But if he just does that and we have two Apexes, that's going to be, we're either going to totally snowball or we're going to fucking just get wrecked in the game. But at the same time, we also don't want only two Maniacs there. We don't want two people just sitting back. You see what I mean? Because to me, that's definitely a thing that even top teams sometimes do get lost in the sauce on. They recruit a player who's a good player, but they haven't thought about that factor. Like, does it add what we need, or does it balance out something else we have? So, like, I've given the example in the past of, like, that's actually why, even though I think both of them are flawed, I thought the Yekindar GM thing worked awesome. Because, again, it's like somehow the polarity of how they played, they were able to sort of exploit this dynamic, and it made it actually, the joke is they made it the opponent's problem. Like, it's actually your problem now that Yekindar super aggro and GM super passive, because your question is which one's there and what are they going to do? So, like, I do think that's an area where it's a subtlety, because it's not as simple again as looking at a stat, but I think that does also get lost in the mix. I mean, to me, that's one of the things about why I didn't hate this move to bring Flames into Vitality. Because even though, like we discussed on the last episode, they're probably still not as good as the team that won the major. The difference is, though, they're way more dangerous and dynamic, though. Like, Dupree was still a good player at times. He doesn't have the ceiling that Flames has. Like, Flames can have a halfway just wins you the game. Dupree did that, like, once in a while, once in a blue moon. You know, it just wasn't in his game anymore. So, like, you can see that, like, the balance is the interesting angle to me, which is also why it's not as simple as just looking at it like the players should know. This is why me and Cassad always say, I want there to be real GMs, like sports, you know, who are trying to build a squad. And because if people don't know in football, et cetera, again, you don't just go and go, like, how much money have I got? Buy the best player that costs that much. You look for the player that brings what you want. And the best managers, Arsene Wenger, Klopp, they're finding someone who's like a specific type of, like, I want a holding defender because I've got issues at the back, or, you know, I need someone to cross the ball into my amazing strikers. You kind of go for what you need in the game, where sometimes in CS, I do get the vibe people just try to recruit the best player, you know, and then they think after the fact we'll figure it out because we're good players, you know.
Yeah, I like your approach of, like, the space, like how much space can be taken. The way I look at it, if I really, like, bird's eye view of the game, the way I see it is a team has to have a degree of predictability in what they're doing, right? Or every team is trying to optimize what they're doing. What gets you there is knowing what's happening, is being reliable, having protocols, right? To an extent. But you're never going to win. You're never going to win if you just follow the same routine from round 1 to round 15. You have to have a little bit of craziness. You have to have a little bit of extravaganza here and there. And you have to have it organized. There is a finite amount of two core values for me in the game. It's movement and decision making. That these are currencies in the game. These are currencies as a player that you can be given or be taken from. You either have movement and you have freedom of decision, or you don't. At the polar opposite is a B anchor on Mirage. A B anchor on Mirage has probably very little of either of these things. Movement, you have a very small bomb site you can move on. There's not a whole lot of moves you can take. And freedom of action, you can, when you feel it, when it's a mid round, maybe push the B apps, but it's very unlikely you can just say, hey, listen, I'm going to push B right now. Good teams will know how to play with that. The other problem is, as well, is that notion of balance you're talking about. When I'm playing my B side of Mirage and I am pushing, in order for my setup on the CT side to make sense, someone has to be on his way back to cover me. Because if I push and I die and there's no cover behind me, the round is over. It's one of these risky moves. So if I'm making my move and I have a teammate coming to me, that means that Apex at the other end of the map cannot do the same thing. Because then we're stretching it thin. We're stretching like a towel that's about to rip, right? So this is why there is a finite amount of movement that you can have in a team and a finite amount of decision-making. And you have to allocate it to the people that do the best with it. Some players are left best in reliable standing position, and some players need to have movement. They need to have freedom. You're going to get all the movement in the simple to Zaiwu, and simple. Simple is the prime example. Simple gets all the movement and he gets all the decision-making because he makes the best out of it, and everyone around it plays around him so they know what's going to happen. But this introduces complexity, and not every team know how to handle it. This is why teams like Heroic, for example, sometimes get completely lost, because they will allow a whole lot of freedom to a whole lot of players, always movement here and there, but it creates mistakes. Like, it's hard to keep up with what the hell is happening. I have a teammate that's pushing the smoke, and I have someone that's already rotating to me, so now certainly we're four on the A side, no one is on B. Who's got my rotation? Who's got the flank? For how long did we lose that information? That enhances complexity. It becomes labor. It becomes complicated. So as a team, you have to be careful and mindful of how much movement and freedom you give to people, and it has to make sense. And this is how I see the game. Not really anchor, entry, whatever. Who's got movement? Who's got freedom? And does it work in the grand scheme of things? Is the final product still something that's sensible, or is it just ridiculous and nothing's happening?
Because this is another area I actually find quite interesting to look at teams, like both now and like looking back in hindsight, is when you analyze squads, there's so many different ways, like lenses you can apply essentially. Like what we're talking about here as well is like when you make a team, it's always like a finely balanced and tuned like machine. It's never as simple as like you just add these things because they are good and therefore you win. Like I don't know if you know this concept, but like the medieval alchemist Paracelsus, who was like a guy who pioneered a lot of scientific concepts that came through medicine, actually used to have a saying where he essentially said what makes something a poison is the dose. So like actually famously, I mean, it even is actually a medical concept now. You can sometimes use a tiny amount of a poison to heal someone. But in the same way, you can actually, if people don't know, you can die from drinking too much water. If you drink too much water, basically your brain expands and you'll just die of like a, I think it's like a hemorrhage or something fucked up like that. So even water can be poisonous in an analogous sense if you have too much, right? That's the same we're making a team. Because the other thing I've learned over the years is this is why the key word is balance. You're trying to like offset things. You're trying to get best of both worlds. You're trying to have this from this player, but then let's offset his weakness with someone else's strength. And really, you do that. That is the fundamental thing that makes a team great for my money. Because if I look at some of the squads that on paper should have been good, but they're never quite as good. Like I'll give a modern example. The last year lineup where they had Sumdai Young in Na'Vi, and then they also got that young player in NPL. Part of why that didn't work, if you ever look, it's not that Bumic. This is why everyone, I think we were right and we were wrong. Bumic wasn't, in my opinion, some great IGL. I mean, spoiler, he didn't even play IGL after that. I don't think he's the IGL now, even in his teams. And if you look at what he was doing, we're not being haters. Like, it clearly was coming from Blade, a lot of it. And then I don't even think he called like a traditional call. Like you say, Simple clearly had the ultimate green light in every respect. Like, he just did whatever he wanted. I would imagine some of the other players might also have had a bit of freedom and things he could chip maybe when Electronic went in. So I think Bumic had like essentially like a limited captain's role, and he maybe triggered some things. But the one upside I always gave credit to Bumic for is even though it looked a bit silly, he was a mega aggro player. Like people know he would unironically be on an SMG running first into the site if it was like Mirage, or on CT side of Inferno he'd be permanently fucking MP9 peeking that corner all the time, right? Even though that looks gimmicky, one thing it meant was you had a very good balance for the really slow style that Na'Vi played. Whereas when they got rid of that, SDY was more of like the supportive element, and then the NPL guy was just so fresh. I get the vibe he couldn't put a foot wrong. Like he knew he couldn't take his own initiative because he's going to get flamed when he loses. So that squad, part of why that squad just was a bit toothless to me was even though you still had Simple who was really good, it was a mega passive team, mate. Like they were, the difference was when they were at their best, they had that monster lineup that won the major, they would go slow but they'd destroy you. Like it was a positive to go slow. This team with SDY and PL, they would go slow, they just do nothing and they lose the round. Like people know you'd fail to get the bomb down, or there'd be a miscommunication late in the round. Or as you're saying, another one that in the modern day is a viable factor is if you're rubbish in post plants and clutch scenarios, you just get exposed in modern CS. Like everyone knows part of the reason why everyone sort of hated on the NPL guy is if he's the last one alive, you sort of go, right, that's the end of the round, isn't it? It's good. And even though occasionally you'd even win the 1v1, but in your brain you go, forget that one. Whereas if that was the old lineup, I always used to say the thing that really shows me a team is the best in the world for me is when like there's no setup in a 2vx that you would want as the opponent. Like when FaZe was in their prime, even Carrigan can win 2vx, guys, mate. Like if you have Carrigan and let's pick the two worst, Carrigan and Rainer in 2vx, dude, of all the like supportive fellas, they can win some of these rounds, boys. No. They can get busy and the opponent knows it too. Meanwhile, if I give the same example, if you're playing Na'Vi of last year and the 2vx is SDY and NPL, you've feeling pretty good about yourself compared to if it's electronic and simple, right? That's actually the 2VX you want to play against. So yeah, I think this is another area that people mistake, is that you can have too much of something that's good and then it becomes bad inherently. Because I've always thought that was the thing, for example, like our old mate Happy went too far with. He didn't realize, like, once upon a time when the game changed, he almost needed to like balance his squad out again. Mm. But he was trying to play that like super one-dimensional style. And it's like, mate, that style works or it doesn't. It was a very fragile style in that sense. And what I always gave him his credit. At one point, it was the best. It did counter the scene. It did break the game. But his problem was when essentially the game changed and it no longer worked, he just rode it till the bitter end. Mm. He just went down with the ship, you know?
Yeah. The way I look at it is the more extreme you are in your playstyle, and you can go either way of the spectrum. You can go too passive, waiting for the last few seconds, or you can be too aggressive. The higher you go on the extreme, or the more extreme you go, rather, the more expectation there is to succeed. Otherwise, it's going to look silly. If you are being over-aggressive all the time, you have to have a higher degree of success than not. Yes. Otherwise, it's going to look like it makes no sense. And I think the poor prime example of that is Kerrigan without confidence, having a 40% entry rate attempt and a 19% success, sure, which is basically a 4v5 guarantee.
Yes.
But the thing is, because of how extreme that is, whenever there is a little bit of success in it, suddenly it changes the whole thing. Because if suddenly he has 40% success rate in these entries, then the space that he created is incredible.
Yes.
And the team can play with it. Same can be said with Navi or VP or whoever. If you are on the polar opposite of that spectrum, you're playing really, really, really slow, but you're so good at these last few rounds, last few seconds, it's fine. It's okay. You're just taking that risk. It just puts a whole lot of pressure on you in terms of success. But there is another topic, and we might keep that for the next one, because that in itself is a Pandora box that is very hard to open. But it also is a question of not every kill is the same in Counter-Strike.
Yes.
Not even close. Not even close.
Yes.
And even though there is a truth to it, if a player has 28 kills or 12, then most likely the 28 kills had a better game. That's very obvious. Absolutely. There is intricacies in the value of kills that just cannot be matched one-to-one. And obviously, what do we all do, and I include myself in it, we look at the rating a whole lot to value a player's performance. I'm the first one to do that. I'm an analyst. I stand at desk and I use that rating time and time again to quantify and qualify a player's performance in the last few months. I do that because I don't have the ability, but just cognitively or the time, to myself come up with another way to value a player quickly. And we also need, we need an alphabet that we can use to talk together.
You need a shorthand. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. You need that. And so I use it for. But the truth is, not every kill is the same. And I know the rating has some of that intricate in it. I know entry kills are valued. I know multi-kills are valued, clutch are valued. And obviously in itself, that is important. But it's something that we have to keep in mind. Some of the role players get kills that have more value than others. If Kerrigan has a 20 kills map, it is a success for him. It is a success. It's a qualified success that's going to put FaZe in a good position. That's it. Whereas if Zywoo or Simple have 25, it's not guaranteed they're winning. Not at all. There's no guarantee they're winning with 25. And this is where our job as being figure of the community is to also kind of decipher that and make sure that whenever the players are getting the 17, 18, 19, 20 that they needed, although they're not topping the scoreboard, have to mention that the job has been done here and a difference has been made. Because this is where role players do suffer from the old everybody goes back to the rating. And once again, I include myself as part of the problem here. I'm very aware of it.
No, I'm totally with you on that. Like, it's why I say, like the example I gave of the Mopos guy earlier, I don't care if he tops the scoreboard. There's games where I just think he won them the game, you know, like what his dynamic added was the, like, it's like you're saying, it's like the key kills, like the ones that no one else could have gotten or would have gone for. It's also why, like you say, there are like classic examples. Actually, we'll use one that we're talking about in this conversation. Old school Apex, when he was the hard entry, the joke was, if you actually had a choice and you were on a team that had Apex and Kenny S, which do I want? Do I want Kenny to drop 30? Which was like breathing air for him. Or do I want Apex to drop 20? Mate, you'd pick Apex dropping 20, because the difference is, with how he was playing hard entry, you're just going to win the game, mate. You're just going to have all the bomb sites, bomb plants. Like, the joke is, at that point, Kenny doesn't need 30. He could probably do like 20 himself, and you've just won the game, maybe handedly. Meanwhile, maybe the 30 from Kenny is just him hard carrying and everyone else's shit on the team. And three of those is like, you know, he's on a save from a 1v4 where he kills three and then hides. Like, those kills don't really mean anything compared to, like, if the Apex, I mean, in the modern day, I actually think Config does this to some degree. Even though I do think he probably is a bit overrated now, he's a player I will never judge off raw rating or like kills or whatever. Because the difference is, when he runs in the site and does just like 3-1 bullet, two people in the bomb site and open a site completely on his own, I mean, that's worth more than two kills. I know on the scoreboard it just goes two kills and then he dies, so he's only got plus one on that maniac. Like that essentially might be the whole round, especially if you're like the crazy ones, like, because I'm picking examples like Apex and Config, where when they go off, they really go off. Like, they just straight up win you the round themselves. Like, they really can do it, even from these not star positions or not the carry position, you know.
Because I think Majisk is a good example too. Majisk is well up there right now. If you look at Vitality and you see Majisk having pop-off game, like, yes, you know, they're on track. He's not going to farm easy kills that have less meaning. If he's getting multi-kills, that's because he's being challenged in his anchor positions. He gets down three. On the T side, he's the second line of attack. There are players for whom the kills is immediately equated with impact. That's just due to their role, and that's it. And it's something that it's not really apparent to the first eye. You have to actually know what it is they're doing, and you have to watch them in the game. And, I mean, we try to do them justice, right? That's all we can do.
Yes,